You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we bring you Professor Peter Phillips on his new book, Giants, the Global Power Elite. Also, we'll hear from Vijay Prashad and Shireen Al-Adeimi on the slaughter in Yemen and the role of the U.S. along with our ally, Saudi Arabia. All that ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and I am delighted to welcome back to these airwaves and the show Peter Phillips, who for many years was the director of Project Censored. Now Mickey Huff has taken over that role, but Peter is still doing the good work, and he has put together a powerful book about the global power elite. The book is called Giants, the Global Power Elite. And Peter Phillips, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Dennis, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's so good to have you with us. This is a big book. Why don't you just give us a bit of a summary of what you tried to do in terms of these movers and shakers who are now controlling the world?
Well, this is a book about the transnational capitalist class, and that's the global 1% who, you know, control half the wealth in the world, if not more. But that's a lot of people. You know, that's millions of people. So we narrowed it down. We say giants. The giants are the top asset management firms with more than $1 trillion. And, you know, a trillion's a lot of money. That's 1,000 billions. So we have companies like BlackRock at $5.4 trillion, Vanguard at $4.3 trillion. And this is money that they invest in global capitalism. So there's 17 of them that are $1 trillion or more. And those are what I call the giants. And those giants controlled in 2017 $41 trillion worth of capital that they invest everywhere in the world. And they're only managed by 199 people. So when we say the global power elite, these 199 are the central policymakers for global capital investment in the world. And those companies are the 17, and this is what was new about the research, is they're all invested in each other. So the 17 have over $400 billion, according to NASDAQ, invested in each other, so that they're one big network of global capital concentration that all governments, the CIA and, you know, intelligence agencies all over the world pay attention to. It's all about protecting global capital and their ability to continue to grow and expand capital, you know, with regular returns, and it's causing serious problems in the world.
Could you paint us a picture of a few of the folks who are at the top calling the shots and something about what they're up to?
Well, you know, Jamie Dimon is in charge of Chase Manhattan Bank, and he wants to privatize Social Security. They're really making recommendations now in terms of you know, global power and structures. He's on the Council of Foreign Relations. He advises the president, even though he withdrew from the president's policy group. They all did after Trump got racist. But they're still very much involved in advising the administration. Lloyd Blankfein, of course, is chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs. And he's worth, $600 million. Diamond's worth $1 billion. There's Larry Fink from BlackRock. He's, you know, on their CEO there, and he's on the Business Roundtable, Council of Foreign Relations, very much involved in global policies. He's a keynote speaker at Davos every year, and he's worth about $600 million. So these are some of the players, some of the top people that are running these giant corporations. And each of these has like 12 to 14 people on their board of directors. They're the ones setting the policies for where that capital gets invested. And they're all watching each other, and they're all invested in each other. So it's this giant network of interconnected capital, 40 trillion, closer to 50 trillion now, that that the whole world pays attention to. And, you know, they want to have a free flow of capital with returns guaranteed and debt collection everywhere in the world. And that's the policies that governments, and I mean, Trump is a functionary for them. And he's been a very effective functionary by allowing capital restoration to the U.S. and changing of the tax laws and allowing banks to reinvest now in a broader way. So it's an ongoing problem. And the biggest part of their problem is they have more capital than they know what to do with. So they don't have enough places for a good guaranteed return or safe investments. So they do speculative investments. And that was what, you know, almost crashed the entire market worldwide in 2008 was the subprime mortgage investments. They knew that was a problem, and they were betting against each other on it. And so they're continually doing that. But the other big problem is they still have more capital than they have good places to invest. But so they're buying up public resources worldwide. So that's land, water rights. It could be universities. It can be, you know, just privatizing the world is that wealth is doing that. And they still don't have enough places to put all their capital. So the countries like the United States and Europe, they accommodate that by having permanent war in the world. So permanent war allows for continued capital growth and expansion for these companies. So all of them, BlackRock, Vanguard, J.P. Morgan, UBS, Bank of America, are all invested in Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Boeing, the three biggest defense contractors, in the tunes of $50 billion-plus for each of those companies. And they're all invested in Amazon, which just, you know, became worth $1 trillion. So, and they pump up 56% of Amazon stock is owned by giant investment companies. And that makes Bezos the richest person in the world. But he's just one big tree in the forest. The book is about the global power elite. It's about the sociology of the forest, the people that are in charge of global capitalism.
Let's talk about they have organizations that work for them, that help them do what they need to do. If they need to put the squeeze on a country or a corporation or a particular group of people, you've got, for instance, explain how organizations like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, NATO, World Trade Association, G7, how do these groupings or how are they used to sustain this kind of a global corporate crew?
Well, all the World Bank, the WTO, the International Monetary Fund, they're all controlled by governments. And the richest governments with the largest economies have the greatest say. So that's the U.S. and Europe. Now, since those are governmental controlled, there's influences within government that their policies are debated and talked about. Outside of government, there are policy groups made up of power elites that are non-governmental associations where they meet and make recommendations and literally give instruction to the World Bank and the IMF. And the number one, the core, what I call the Central Committee of Global Capitalism, is a group of 30. The G30, they have 32 people on their board, one woman, Gail Kelly from Australia, Bankers Association, and the rest are central bankers, there are people from the House of Lords, there's former president of Mexico's on there, and this group of only 32 people, they meet in Washington, D.C., they're privately funded, and when they put out reports regularly that are seen by governments as not just policy recommendations, but literally instructions of what needs to happen. So this is a private group, and that's where we get into the idea of the global power elite. They're non-governmental. The other big group is a trilateral commission, which was set up by the Rockefeller and Brzezinski back in the early 70s. And they have over 40 nations involved, but they're all non-governmental kinds of positions. They're the ones that put out a report 5 years ago saying Putin really needed to be removed. And, you know, containment of Russia. That was an Atlantic Council report that came out, or the Trilateral Commission. The other big group is the Atlantic Council, which are NATO members that meet privately. They're not government-funded, and they make recommendations for changes in what government should be removed and proceed from there, what kind of security mechanisms. The Atlantic Council is the one who's advising right now Facebook and Google as to how to make the adjustments to eliminate what they call the extremists.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's sort of funny. We're speaking with Peter Phillips. Peter's going to be with Mickey Huff next week, and he'll be speaking about this book, Giant, the Global Power Elite. And Mickey will be talking about the new edition of Censored 2019, and that's next Tuesday, the 30th, at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Peter, you write in the preface, this concentration of protected wealth leads to a crisis of humanity whereby poverty, war, starvation, mass alienation, media propaganda, and environmental devastation are reaching a species-level threat. Say more about that.
Well, 80% of the people in the world live on less than $10 a day. So the comparison of that 80% to the lives of the top 20% and certainly the lives of the power elite is just immense. You know, we have half the world living on less than $2.50 a day, and 1.3 billion people live on $1.25 a day. The big problem is that 30,000 people a day die from starvation and malnutrition.
30,000 a day.
30,000 a day. And there's enough food to feed everybody. A third of the food in the world gets wasted because it isn't profitable. So, you know, these capital investment, is destroying the world environmentally. 70% of the CO2 gases have come from only 100 companies, and those companies are highly invested by the giants. So, you know, all the big oil companies, they're heavily invested in this. So that capital concentration, the power elite, that $50 trillion of investment capital controlled by a couple hundred people is driving environmental destruction of the world, driving inequality, driving mass starvation, and accelerates wars so they can make profits.
I'm wondering, just putting this in the context of current events, you've got the Saudis now with incredible wealth amassed. How does a country and a kingdom like that fit into this global power elite? I mean, are they recognized? Are they
they're
catered
part of the
to?
Network. There are Saudis on each of these policy councils. They're on the boards of some of these giant transnational investment companies. They're on the board of BlackRock. And so their capital is part of the global capital elite and is used for investment and expansion. But they're closely interlocked. The Saudis are closely interlocked with the U.S. CIA and our intelligence agencies so that we were undermining countries like Iran, Venezuela, and Russia by lowering oil prices a decade ago. And the Saudis went along with that by putting out mass amounts of oil that brought the prices down. And so the Saudis are used to manipulate oil prices in the world. And they're very much in league with our intelligence agencies, which are all about protecting global capital.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are talking about Peter Phillips' new book, Giant, the Global Power Elite. And it is terrifying that so few people have amassed so much power through their money. One would think that they don't need any more, but it's beyond just controlling resources. It's about controlling the future of the world, isn't it? These are folks who want...
It's definitely about controlling the future of the world, but they're kind of trapped in this capitalism problem, which is the requirement for continued growth. Capitalism is like riding a bicycle. You got to keep moving forward and putting more weight on, so to speak, adding greater capital amounts. And the minute you stop, you fall over. That's called stagnation economically. And jobs are lost and unemployment and there's no profits being made. And we end up in a giant structural recession, or a depression, similar to 29. And there's a number of people like William Robinson, who writes the introduction to the book, are saying that we're scheduled for that very soon, certainly in our lifetime. And when I say our lifetime, you know, I'm near retirement age. So we're looking at a global economic crisis because you cannot continue to concentrate wealth the way this has been happening with so few people in the world, and they think that they'll keep to grow and it'll trickle down, and it doesn't trickle down. People just get poorer, more people die, wars get more intense, and the environmental destruction is devastating. So they're in a problem. And so one of the things we do in the book is not only do we name the ones, the 389 people who are the players in this world capitalism at the core, but we also write them a letter signed by some 90 people who are saying that, look, you know, you have grandchildren, and you want to be thinking about their grandchildren. It's time to make an adjustment in capitalism whereby world economic resources go down to every family, every child in the world, that there's a river downward, not a trickle down. And that just has to happen. And short of them doing something, which a lot of people don't think they will do, we have to pressure them. Social movements have to challenge them. And we hope that that they will recognize that this is inevitable, the change, before environmental and civil unrest destroys the world.
Talk about the role that the corporate media now plays in this context. It used to be that this was the fourth estate. They were to report. They were supposed to monitor the centers of power and report back to the people. Let us know what's going on in the Pentagon, in Congress, in the corporation. Who are the media now? What role do they play in this sustaining of these powerful elites?
Well, they're called the ideologists. They're chapter 6 in my book. All the big media companies, Disney, Time Warner, Fox, Comcast, Bartlesman, Viacom, are heavily invested by the giants. So these giant capitalists have literal control over these media companies, and the media companies are getting their content from big public relation firms like Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group. These are giant multi-billion dollar public relation firms with offices all over the world that package the news. They will tell us what's happening, and they work for private corporations, they work for governments, they work for the State Department, they work for the Pentagon. So most of our news content, literally 80% of our news content in major corporate media, is prepackaged managed news through public relations firms that the corporate media run as if they had done it.
And what is the hope here, Peter?
Well, the hope is that we can intercede by identifying who the power elite are, which this is what this book does. We do bios on them. We say who they're connected with, what boards they're on, what is their public wealth, where they went to school, you know, and so that's a lot of personal information about these 300 people. And as you read their bios, you start to go, okay, I get it. This is who they are. And we, now that we've named them, we can start to ask them personally to fix this and to say, we've got you, you know, you are part of this global power elite. You need to address this gross inequality in the world and do something about it. And they're going to say, well, we can't do anything. And you say, yes, you can. And then there's going to have to be, you know, social pressure, political pressure, social movement pressures, resistance in a variety of ways that says, you've got to fix this. And the greater the pressure, the more likely we will hopefully see some changes that allow for some real transformation of what global capitalism is and stop the continued consolidation of wealth in the world.
Have you ever been able to find any of these, say, the top 17 or 20, and ask them a question?
They're pretty hard to reach. I invited 50 of them to come to my book release in New York, the ones that were there. I sent emails. You can't get their emails, but you can send it to their companies.
They probably couldn't get a cheap flight or something.
But none of them came. But, you know, they want to just ignore this. But hopefully this book is going to be strong enough that it won't be ignored. It's already getting sold all over the world and being translated into Spanish and Portuguese and Turkish at this point. And we're hopefully even more, because we need to know who the global power elite are. This is the names of who they are. These are the people that are the players and control trillions of dollars worth of investment capital.
Did you see, were you inspired by occupation of Wall Street and that movement against the 1%, do you see that as one of the
Well, they left
hopes?
Us with a, that was one of the reasons I wrote this book, because, you know, we have the mantra now, the 1% versus the 99%, and people understand what that means. And there's resistance movements all over the world, but we didn't know who you have to do a lot of research to figure out who are the real people in charge of global capital, and that's what this does. And then we have the ones that are protecting it through the Atlantic Council, the ones that are forging policy through the Council of 30 and the Trilateral Commission. And then, of course, the media are the ideologists saying everything's wonderful, don't worry.
Well, we're out of time, but I just want to let people know that I am a fan of this book, a supporter of the kind of work you've done for so many years. This obviously grows out of your work with Project Censored, and I want to let people know that you will be with Mickey Huff October 30th here in the Bay Area. For those of you listening in the Bay Area, that's going to be happening at the First Congregational Church next Tuesday at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Again, if you're in the area, if you're not in the area, the book is relevant to you as well. Giant, The Global Power Leap by Peter Phillips. Peter, thank you for spending all the time that you must have spent on this work to make sure this book came together in the way that it did.
Well, it's been years of progress, and I've had lots of help, a lot of students here at Sonoma State, and then, of course, the Media Freedom Board, Mickey and Andy, have been really generous in terms of support and advice. So it's been an interesting experience.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for doing the book and for joining us today on Flashpoints. We appreciate
Thanks very much,
the information.
Tim.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Trading. He's the outlaw on these pavements. Kids get cuffed just for misbehaving. In the White House, guns are trading. Some go jail because his guns are blazing. Up in Parliament, guns are trading. Some choose crime as an occupation. They sell guns to destroy a nation. Who's the criminal? Where's the justice? We don't trust no judges' judgments. On these front lines, losing patience. Who protects us from their invasions? We protect us, holding corners. Police ain't welcome across the borders. Arrest the president. He's the gangster. Deep in scandals, dirty bankster. Why harass me? I'm just struggling, making something out of nothing. It's the system. Arrest the president. We're the victims. The world's the evidence. Arrest the president.
He's the gunslinger.
Arrest the president.
He's the arms dealer.
Arrest the president. Arrest the president.
Can't stand how our leaders lie. I make power moves they justify. We're half-baked stories the people buy. It's all just spin making us comply with the plans of the Western man that's so greedy, so self-righteous and so full of talking about the rule of law and democracy. The president's precedent is bare hypocrisy. Teaching the way of the gun, gun, gun. This is how the West was won. Why should we believe a word of it? The media's biased and Bush is murderous. I don't want them policing me. I didn't vote for your racist thievery. I lose hope because you bring out the beast in me. I feel the winds of change blow easterly and corruption's all around us. American elections rigged, the morality flounders. You can't tell me this shit, so don't even attempt. Millions like me feel content. Hating Bin Laden, I feel exempt. Nothing's been proven to any extent. We resent. You think we're meant to swallow lies when we know you're bent. Arrest the president.
He's the arms dealer.
Arrest the president.
He's the gunslinger.
Arrest the president.
He's the real liar.
Arrest the president.
He's the dictator.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. There is a lot happening in this world, and every so often we like to check in, particularly in times like this, with somebody who knows a lot about what's going on, can put a lot of things together, and spends a lot of time traveling to find out what's happening in this world. That's Vijay Prashant. He's the executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. They have offices in Argentina, South Africa, India, and Brazil. Vijay Prashant, it's good to have you back with us. There's a lot going on in this world. I hope you don't mind if I start with this caravan thing, or exodus, whatever you want to call it. It is interesting now that the second spontaneous or not group of people getting together coming out of El Salvador is being reported through the eyes of Homeland Security, as in Homeland Security is tracking this second caravan as it forms. Your thoughts on all of this?
Well, nice to be with you, Dennis. You know, this is a very long-standing tragedy, and I think one should see it like that. After all, as you well know, the United States has for at least 7 decades, if not longer really, maybe a century, politically destabilized Central America. The United States has used Honduras in particular as a kind of military lily pad of, you know, a landlocked aircraft carrier from which to attack El Salvador and Nicaragua. That was during the dirty wars of the 1980s. And more recently, Dennis, I think this is something quite considerable. The perils of climate change have really hit Central America quite hard. And, you know, if you look at the various UN reports, what one finds is that the climate change issue has turned their harvests around. And, you know, small farmers, this is what actually in many ways, you know, defines agriculture in Central America. Small farmers have been hit very hard. So, you know, you might think of the bananas of Honduras. It's worthwhile to go and see how the banana harvest is doing. So these people who are walking across the length of, you know, the isthmus up into Mexico and towards the United States, they have in their bodies written the history of U.S. intervention in that area. And I think people in the United States need to recognize that.
All right. I really did want to get your take on that. I want to let people know later on we'll be going to Mexico City. We'll be getting some reports on the ground. And obviously we're watching all of this very closely. Vijay Prashad does very important work now with the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. They put out a series of newsletters. They're on their 34th, and these are newsletters that deal with the structural, crucial issues of our time. Your number 34 is entitled "The Monstrous Anger of the Guns." You deal with the profound threat and expanding reality of famine in several countries, and you talk a lot about the politics of Yemen, which has again had a spotlight thrown on it by the kidnap killing at the Saudi embassy in Turkey. Could you tell us why the title and something about your latest travels?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, Dennis, it's very interesting for people who've been watching Saudi Arabia and the UAE's war against Yemen since the early part of 2015. It's very interesting for us to, you know, see how people have reacted to the death of a Saudi journalist. I mean, the killing of the journalist certainly is very meaningful. It should be strongly condemned. I think all that is correct. But of course, you know, we have to put this in perspective. I mean, the United States has been selling Saudi Arabia and the UAE, not just the United States, also Great Britain, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of weaponry. In other words, Saudi Arabia has very cleverly, over the past few decades, been buying immunity from criticism by using its oil wealth to purchase weapons. And over the course of the past several decades, it has basically warehoused these weapons, allowed them to rot. You know, these have been a kind of bribe to prevent any criticism of the kingdom. Well, in the last 3 years, Saudi Arabia has been using these weapons sold by the United States and Britain to annihilate, you know, Yemen. And let me just give you two statistics. There are 28 million people who live in Yemen, and the United Nations has said 14 of them live in currently or on the threshold of famine. A UN agency said that last year, 130 children died every day. I just want to repeat that last statistic. The UN agency said that last year in 2017, 130 children, 130 children died every day. I think, you know, we need to really use this opportunity to come and look directly into the mouth of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. It's one thing to be shocked at the killing of a journalist. I think it's quite another to be, I think, personally implicated in the selling of arms to a country that has killed last year 130 children per day.
And what about the sort of role that war now plays with tremendous U.S. support in the actual expansion of famine? I mean, if this goes on unchecked, if the Saudis continue to have free reign, and it really looks like they can, I was thinking the other day about how Trump said he could get away with shooting somebody, you know, up midtown Manhattan in the middle of the day. This is sort of the Saudi equivalent of that. And what if this policy, nobody checks this policy, where is this going? How long can Yemen stand without it being essentially becoming a mobile country heading for where? The United States?
It's a very good question. You know, the issue is that one has to also recognize that the Yemenis have held off the Saudis and the Emiratis since March 2015. In other words, the Saudis and the Emiratis, that is the UAE, have had to maintain aerial bombardment against Yemen. They haven't been able to send in ground forces. And the reason they haven't been able to do that is despite the asymmetry of the war, despite, you know, the fact that there's immense internal problems, the Emiratis have and the Saudis have been blocked by fighters of Yemen. I mean, this is quite an important part of the story. Yemen is not just the victim here. It has held off this bombardment, this monstrous bombardment from Saudi Arabia and Yemen. But, you know, the UN has been very, very cautious in its statements. When it came up with the number of 130 children a day who died last year, this was not an estimate. But at the same time, the UN has said that many Yemeni families are too poor to get to health centers, that this number may be, in fact, an underestimate. You know, the real number may be much higher. And what you're asking, how long can this continue? I mean, this could continue indefinitely, because despite the stories in the international media, the British and the Americans continue to supply Saudi Arabia and the UAE with weapons. The world continues to buy oil from Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In other words, money continues to flow into these countries, and these countries continue to buy weapons. What is the need to stop? The only reason to stop bombing Yemen is when 28 million Yemenis are dead.
You know, and sort of put that in the context, if you will, of the bottom line, the U.S. bottom line, which is the bottom line. We sell lots of weapons, jobs. We don't give a damn what they did over there. We're going to keep going. And I'm not sure Obama would have been much different.
Well, Obama was not different at all. I mean, that's the key issue here. You know, the United States has been selling arms to Saudi Arabia, regardless of the president. I mean, the United States, as you know, is the world's largest arms seller in the world. You know, commands almost 40% of the world market. Saudi Arabia is the biggest buyer of U.S. arms. It buys about 20% of U.S. arms. And here's the most important thing. It's from the last years of the Obama administration till today, U.S. sales of arms to Saudi Arabia has increased by 448%. In other words, there is no drop in arms sales despite this war. You know, the callousness that is demonstrated by the merchants of debt is breathtaking. I mean, you know, you asked a second ago, what would stop this? Certainly not a 448% increase in arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
And in the current budget, of course, let's not forget about that $38 billion plus package for Israel in the context of what's going on there with the destruction and starvation and killing of Gazans, mass murder. It's mass murder on the front line where the protest is, and mass murder on the back line where people and children are sort of dying and falling apart from the kind of brain damage that comes from a lack of real water, pure water. I mean, this is all of a piece, isn't it? Trump just cut off the Palestinians, but he's talking about this $110 billion. How do you, I mean, I'm sorry, how do you make sense of this, VJ?
Well, you know, you're talking about the United States government policy, which was actually pushed by the Israeli far right. I mean, the Israeli far right has for many years felt that the UN agency tasked with relief for the Palestinian refugees, that UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, set up right after the Palestinians were ejected from their homeland. The Israeli far right has basically said that UNRWA is like Hamas, and both need to have their heads cut off. I mean, they have been quite vicious towards UNRWA. And this is the first U.S. administration, the Trump administration, to accept the Israeli far-right's view and cease funding to UNRWA. Now, one thing to say, Dennis, sensible people understand that UNRWA basically provides, you know, some employment in the refugee camps. But UNRWA is the most important educator of Palestinian children. And I think even liberal, Zionists in Israel acknowledge that absent UNRWA, there will be no stabilizing institution inside the Palestinian camps. And in fact, much more radical forces are going to arrive. So this might be the policy that comes in to bite you. But you're exactly correct. It is of a piece with the kind of war one sees against the people of Yemen, and how these are related is, this is where you get to the point where a people become basically invisible. You know, the population of Yemen has become invisible. The Palestinians are invisible. The Rohingya people in, you know, the borderlands between Burma and Bangladesh, they are invisible. The people marching in these caravans up Central America through Mexico, these are invisible. You know, you're not interested in their stories. You can put any history on them. I mean, Trump is saying that among these people marching up Central America are Middle Eastern people. You know, every single Associated Press reporter that has been along and talked to people on these caravans have reported there are no people of Middle Eastern descent. But you can write anything on these people's bodies, because they are essentially invisible.
Let me come back to the letter before we have to let you go, just to sort of take the spotlight again off of the one horrific killing at the embassy in Turkey. You talk about in the letter the prisoners of conscience catalogs coming out of Twitter and the extent of repression and vicious response to various forms of free speech in Saudi Arabia.
Well, to use the word free speech in Saudi Arabia in a sentence is absurd. You know, I mean, they don't belong together.
Forgive me.
You know, they have prisons where people who want the very smallest change are thrown in. It's very important to remember that Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed brutally in Istanbul, was a defender of the Saudi war in Yemen, was a close confidant of the royal family, was an advisor to Faisal al-Turki, who for many years was the intelligence chief of Saudi Arabia, was a childhood friend of Osama bin Laden. I mean, this guy is the Saudi establishment. The fact is that he merely disagreed with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia on a few points, and that was sufficient to kill him. Now imagine if somebody has more than a little disagreement with the Crown Prince. You know, it's a dangerous country. It's nowhere near a democracy, and it's kind of monumentally bizarre that the United States has this country as its principal ally as it promotes democracy in other parts of the region. It is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Well, I think that I guess I have to, before I let you go, I have to say, and where is the hope? You've been traveling around. You've been speaking with people. I always sort of find hope in the places where people are actually active and trying to make structural change like you do and report on in your newsletters. So where's the hope?
There is always hope, Dennis. I mean, the very fact that these are ordinary people who've decided to flee, they're very difficult situations in countries like Honduras, and have decided with their children to walk hundreds of miles northward, you know, with the sense that something can improve in their lives. These are human beings, and these are human beings with hope in their eyes. You know, I think it's important for the rest of us to look into their eyes and to see hope, and not just see the mass of people coming northward as it were to steal your house. I mean, look into their eyes, feel the hope, and understand that when pushed against the wall, people are resilient. And I think that's where I take a courage, you know, for us to imagine something different than what we live in.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We're going to leave it right there. Vijay Prashad, Executive Director, Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, offices around the world, doing very good work, important work. Thanks for the good information, Vijay.
Thanks a lot, Dennis.
All right. Take it easy. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our attention on Yemen. And our next guest has asked the question, really, has the apparent torture murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi accomplished what 50,000 Yemen death could not? She is referring to the war. Her piece is incredibly important in the context of what's going on now in terms of the latest Saudi assassination. At least that's what it looks like. And she writes in this most recent piece, for over 3.5 years, Saudi Arabia has been waging a brutal attack on its poorest neighbor, Yemen, causing the killings of as many as 50,000 people and the silent deaths of 113,000 children who have perished from malnutrition and preventable diseases like cholera. Well, Professor, we are glad to have you back. We're not happy about what is continuing to happen in your homeland, and we wanted to talk to you about this piece. It does look like the killing in Turkey has called attention to the slaughter in the U.S.-supported slaughter in a way that has yet to sort of have an impact on what's going on. You want to talk about your response first to the what appears to be the Saudi assassination of this Washington Post journalist?
Well, I think this one instance kind of highlights the brutality of the regime, and specifically the actions of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who has been, you know, acting with impunity in Yemen. He's not been questioned about creating the world's worst humanitarian crisis in any kind of critical way. He was welcomed by the U.S. when he visited earlier this year. And for the first time, I think he's realizing that people are really not okay with his brutality. And what we're hearing about what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, I think, is a stark reminder of this regime and what they're capable of doing and what they've been doing in Yemen for the past 3.5 years. To millions of people in the country.
Well, just take a moment to remind people who might not understand the violence and the extent of the violence and the role, the extensive role that the United States government is playing in this violence that is leading to famine.
Right. So it began in 2015 as a civil war, and it soon escalated into this international attack led by Saudi Arabia. They formed a coalition of several Arab countries, and they were very quickly supported by the Obama administration at the time, and then they continued to be supported during the Trump administration. And it's basically an intervention in Yemeni affairs. They began a bombing campaign, which they thought was going to end in a couple of weeks. They named it Decisive Storm, and this was the Crown Prince's first big project since gaining power, since his father became king, and he was appointed defense minister and at the time deputy crown prince. He's since been promoted to crown prince. And the bombing campaign has led to, like I said earlier, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They've bombed homes and schools and hospitals and destroyed the economy of a nation that was already poor and struggling. and the blockade that they've been imposing on people, trapping people into the in the country and preventing them from leaving, preventing food and medicine to enter the country without Saudi permission. That's led to this famine that we're talking about now, where, you know, millions of people are going to starve to death if the war doesn't end by the end of the year, which is just in a couple of months. And the U.S., unfortunately, has been helping them every step of the way, not just with weapon sales, but also with logistical support, with training of Saudi soldiers, and with mid-air refueling in Yemeni skies.
Are you surprised by the sort of the linguistics coming out of Washington? There are a lot of people who supported the Saudi relationship and supported this war for a long time who are sort of acting high and holy, but they have blood on their hands. Is this contradiction bother you a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the examples of this contradiction is, you know, Senator Marco Rubio or Senator Corker, who've been, you know, huge supporters of the war, and the bills that have come into the Senate over the last 3 years, they have opposed any kind of bill to stop aid to Saudi or stop weapon sales to Saudi Arabia or to end the U.S.'s relationship with Saudi Arabia in, you know, with regard to Yemen. And now they're coming across as defenders of human rights, and, you know, they don't want to be tainted by this so-called, you know, blood of Khashoggi. But the move just doesn't make sense given their previous record. But it's important, nonetheless, for people to be opposed to this and to be opposed so strongly to what has happened to Khashoggi. And if it means shedding light on Yemen, finally, and shedding light on the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., then, you know, hopefully now they'll do it. They didn't do it before, but hopefully now's the time.
Well, perhaps this would be the time, but we also know that the Saudis have greatly increased their money spent in the United States, not just buying politicians, but buying think tanks. And some of these think tanks are now being used by various news organizations like NPR as if they're unbiased players. This is also a problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think we always have to follow the money. People, you know, the Saudis don't give money without strings attached, or the UAE doesn't give money without strings attached. And we know that they have powerful lobbyists in Washington. And we can't pretend that these think tanks are objective. But again, this kind of highlighting of the think tanks' money, this work should have been done. Where the money comes from should have always been scrutinized. It hasn't been. But if that conversation is happening now, then, you know, that is welcome. And we really have to recognize the power that the Saudis and the Emiratis have in the U.S., not just, you know, through weapon sales or huge weapon military contracts that they have in the U.S., but also through their relationship with think tanks.
And I think it's important for people to understand, you talked a little bit about this, but the United States, it's not just a few advisors here and there. It's not a few discussions with the Saudi. The United States is playing a structural part in what is empowering the Saudis to carry out this vicious, really genocidal war.
Right. The U.S. is co-belligerent in the war against Yemen, which includes the UAE and other countries. And so I think, you know, I heard reports that Mohammed bin Salman is surprised and offended that the U.S. is questioning him and withdrawing support. Various people within the U.S. are withdrawing support because of this latest revelation about what they've done with Khashoggi. But that surprise only comes because he's been supported by the U.S. for the past 3.5 years. Since he took power, he's been supported and he's been seen as a close ally. And, you know, like I said, he was welcomed by celebrities and business people alike and politicians, of course. And so he's not used to any kind of critique. He's not used to people questioning the statements that come out of Saudi Arabia with regard to Yemen, for example. The statements that they've given over the last 20 days regarding Khashoggi have changed multiple times, and Yemenis are used to that. Or people who've been following Yemen, like I'm sure you have been, are used to that. We're used to denials and, you know, stories changing, but they usually don't get any kind of scrutiny. And the Saudis are allowed to investigate their own crimes, for example, in Yemen. So they're probably wondering why they don't get to investigate this crime. So, yeah, I think that, you know, for the large part, the U.S. is part of the reason why he's become so powerful and why he's been acting with impunity and, you know, was given the sense that he could continue carrying out whatever he feels like it without any kind of questioning or, you know, being held to any kind of standards or accountability.
Can I ask you to talk in the most personal way, sort of your gut reaction when you hear Trump and really the others aren't as vocal in their articulation of this, but they're talking bottom line money. This is money for the United States government. This is money for arms manufacturers. You know, this may be a terrible thing, but the bottom line here is that we've got, you know, these are jobs, jobs, jobs. How does that sit with you, and how do you relate to that?
I mean, Trump is being honest about it at the very least. If this was the Obama administration, I'm sure we'd hear, you know, something about human rights being first and foremost while the weapon sales continue. And so at the very least, Trump is being transparent and honest about what really matters, which is, like you said, money. It's unfortunate that we get to choose money over people's lives, but this is not new. This is what, you know, powerful countries do all the time, right? They prioritize weapon sales and making money for the country over other people's lives, especially if these wars don't affect us here at all. We don't really know what's going on. It's happening elsewhere, far away from us, and we're not affected by it in any way. U.S. soldiers are not dying, so there's no reason to really question our role and the role of our weapons and the role of our advisors and so on. But I think it's a big hypocrisy to say that we're a country that cares for human rights and we're going to sanction people because of human rights abuses and whatnot, and then we go on and commit these human rights abuses alongside people like the Saudis with our weapons, with our military might, and we don't stop to bat an eye, even though we know that we've created the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth.
And just finally, talk a little bit about the personal tragedy. You are among many in this country and around the world who daily wonder what's happening with friends and relatives. What has that been like? Are you in touch with others who are in this struggle? How do you deal with that? Do you try and reach out regularly and get information from alternative channels to figure out how deadly the situation is? Because the corporate press hasn't been great. There are some exceptions. But could you talk about that?
Yeah, for me personally, I joined Twitter the day that the war began on March 26, 2015, because I was turning on the channel and not hearing anything about it. And I knew from family back home that there was bombing. And, you know, I just didn't know what was going on. And so I ended up connecting with a lot of people over Twitter, a lot of Yemenis who've turned into reporters, you know, who've turned their cell phone cameras on and started taking pictures and recording and uploading really just the horrors of what they're experiencing on a daily basis. And then, of course, being in touch with family through WhatsApp mostly and trying to figure out if everybody's okay. Every time there's a bomb that drops, every time we hear that there's fighting in a certain region, I have family all over the country in Yemen, and it's a rush to the phones to try to make sure if everybody made it out okay. For us, it's been a really stressful time. It's heartbreaking. It's frustrating. It's alienating because, you know, all of these years later, and it really breaks my heart to even say that this has been going on for years because of just the sheer magnitude of what's been happening over there. But, you know, you talk to people and they still have no idea what's going on. They have no idea how people's lives over there have been destroyed by our government in coordination with the Saudis. And, you know, we take it day by day. We try to do our best for the people in Yemen because at the end of the day, they're the ones who are suffering the most. They're the ones who don't know if they're going to survive the next morning. They don't, you know, many people have not been paid any salaries or they've lost their jobs or their businesses. They can't travel outside the country, you know, they can't afford food and medicine for their children, and so we just have to continue advocating on their behalf because nobody's really listening to what's going on to them, and nobody's doing anything about their plight. Everybody's just making a lot of money out of their own suffering. So I think for those of us here in the West who are able to be vocal about what's going on and hold our own governments responsible, we just see this as a duty.
in that regard, are you recommending, there is some legislation, there are some Congress folk who are considering different things. Is there anything you would recommend that people get involved with that call their Congress people about?
Absolutely. I think that's the one way out for this war is through Congress. And currently in the House, there's a bill called HCON Resolution 138, and it was introduced by Congressman Ro Khanna. This is the second attempt at a war powers resolution in the House. And I hope that as many people as possible would call their Congress people. So far, there are 56 co-sponsors, which is a good sign, but we need a lot more, and urge them to support this bill. The bill aims to end all U.S. support to the Saudi Arabians. Again, this is not a call for intervention. This is the very opposite. We're asking the U.S. to stop supporting the Saudis in this carnage. And Bernie Sanders also announced that he was going to reintroduce SJ Res 54 in the Senate, which also calls for the same thing, and it didn't go very far back in March, but he's going to attempt again. So hopefully people will call their senators and congresspeople as soon as possible and urge them to support these bills.
Marco Rubio came up with a bit of a statement. He suggested, quote, there's not enough money in the world to buy back our credibility on human rights if we do not move forward and take swift action in regard to the killing of the journalist. Did you find that heartening?
I mean, I wonder where all of this passion is coming from. Again, he voted against a bill last year to block the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia. And, you know, SJ Res 54, he voted to table it. And so if he was so concerned about human rights, about one person's human rights, why wasn't he concerned about millions of people's human rights in Yemen? We're talking about the same country, the same regime, the same crown prince who's been doing these terrible things in Yemen. But so I don't know if this is politically motivated for him to say that, but again, I welcome any critique and of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. government.
All right. Well, we thank you for taking the time out. As always, we are troubled by the kind of policies that the United States government is supporting with the Saudis. We do as much reporting as we can on this. And, of course, we're watching very closely because, obviously, this is turning into a growing famine, and the suffering is immense. And as you say, it's really not on the radar, even though the violence is clear, and there's a lot of people at the grassroots level who are disturbed. So we're going to watch it very closely. Professor, we thank you for taking out the time, and I want to let people know that your recent piece is Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His disappearance has accomplished what 50,000 Yemeni deaths could not. It's, I guess, published by NBC, yes? We appreciate you taking the time out, all right? So you
I
take
really
care.
Appreciate you continuing to cover this. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye now.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. And special thanks to Freewheelin' Frank Sterling for production. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, How Schools Turn Children into Industrial Robots by Design. Why the Power Elite Likes Popular Violence and Hatred, and more. It's all in part two of the film Human Resources. I hope you'll stay tuned. Film, the documentary has been having a rebirth in recent decades. Credit for this is often given to filmmaker Michael Moore, producer of Roger and Me, Fahrenheit 9/11, and other film hits. I'm grateful to Moore for reviving the genre, but actually, I'm not a big fan of his films. I think he plays fast and loose with the facts. His politics are too close to the middle of the road. He thinks flashy stunts prove a point. And he just doesn't come across as very smart. At least to my jaundiced eye. I'm not saying that Scott Noble is a better filmmaker than Moore in the technical sense. Noble is certainly less of a business success. That may be because he gives his films away, and nobody gets charged admission. But in Scott Noble's work, I see a shrewd intelligence and also a radical perspective on our social problems. Both virtues are surely needed these days, as John Dewey himself said close to a century back. Noble's film Human Resources focuses on how a powerful elite controls a society that is supposedly a democracy. They do it by systematically robbing the demos, that's the common people, robbing us of money, sure, but also robbing us of power, robbing us of control, and even robbing us of the ability to understand what is being done to us. Sovereign human beings are being reduced to mere human resources. Last week's installment focused on managing the workplace, how the principles of efficiency expert Charles Winslow Taylor and his ilk systematically reduced the power of workers to control the workplace, or even to influence the workplace. This week, the film turns to our public schools. We see how, from their very founding, schools are designed not to educate children, still less to empower them, but basically to turn them into predictable cogs in the machine that is the U.S. economic system. This segment features the right-wing educational critic John Taylor Gatto and the center-left educational critic Alfie Cohn. They may be far apart on the political spectrum, but they see pretty much eye to eye on what the schools are really up to. The focus then shifts to the sources of violence in our society, and how the elite encourage the oppressed to fight amongst ourselves. This keeps us from uniting and battling our real enemy, the elite. Let us now hear our second installment of Scott Noble's documentary film, Human Resources.
One of Frederick Taylor's descendants, John Taylor Gatto, has rebelled against his forebears' legacy. An award-winning teacher, he has also rebelled against the state of his profession.
An Albert Einstein quote, "Education is what remains after one has forgotten everything he learned in school." John Taylor Gatto.
The key is the word compulsion. The idea of drawing all young people into some universal program administered by the leader or the leaders is as old as Plato, probably older. But nowhere on earth was that able to be imposed until northern Germany, under the military rule of the Prussians, finally imposed that in 1818, so in the first, second decade of the 19th century. That is the first time. It was announced in other places, but never was it able to be successfully administered because the idea is so crazy and so damaging inherently that people simply disobeyed the law. The experience of Prussian Germany was that it was possible to convert sovereign human beings into human resources. That's a translation of a German compound. And that by making these people incomplete, making them unable to think in contexts, but they could be converted into specialist tools for management, scientific management. Horace Mann was hired by the railroad and coal interests of New England to bring about compulsion. He had no interest in schooling. He was an ambitious young politician. He did get compulsion laws passed in 1852, once it was in Massachusetts, it spread very, very slowly. It wasn't for 15 more years that another state followed suit. So it hardly was a gift to the populist portion of America. I smile a little bit when I say that, because the mythology is that it was greeted everywhere with great enthusiasm.
Not only did parents resist compulsory schooling, they sometimes did so violently. So vehement was the opposition in Barnstable on Cape Cod that state militia were brought in to march children to school under armed guard. A primary reason why the mass of the American population resisted compulsory schooling was a widespread belief that its purpose had little to do with education and everything to do with control. Their suspicions were well-founded. An undercurrent of class warfare runs through early American education documents. The U.S. Bureau of Education Circular of Information for April 1872 explains that inculcating knowledge teaches workers to be able to perceive and calculate their grievances, thus making them more redoubtable foes in labor struggles. Such an enabling is bound to retard the growth of industry. 16 years later, in the report of the Senate Committee on Education, is equally explicit. We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years manifesting itself among the laboring classes.
The first Red Scare, in my judgment, is the trigger event for the embedment of compulsion schooling in the United States. The Red Scare of 1848 is probably the reason that one American state fell under the compulsion regimen. There are literally thousands of books from the period 1880 to, say, 1920, roughly, that deal with how you scientifically engineer a factory or a church congregation or young people in school. School, which followed a general outline of converting kids into obedient tools, now took on a very, very mechanistic aspect under this surge of scientific engineering.
In 1903, the Atlantic Monthly called for adoption of scientific management in schools. Prominent education theorist William C. Bagley stressed a need for unquestioned obedience. The new system were trained children for life in 20th century America. Their role, to fulfill the needs of commerce, industry, and government.
In a community with the best education, more shoppers, more merchandise moving, a higher average of per capita sales. In the other community, fewer shoppers. Maybe things will look up in the long run. In the first community, there's a larger magazine circulation per 1,000 population. A much smaller circulation in the second community, a decline in demand. The student of typing, shorthand, and business machines becomes a producer upon graduation, a tax-developed community asset. He prepares for radio and electronics. His future promises a profit on the taxes invested in him. As education raises the cultural level, so it must also introduce youth to the know-how of production and stir interest in precision, efficiency, and service. With graduation, the community receives a new supply of young people who want a better life on the one hand and who have the ability to work for it on the other. Now the tax investment returns to the taxpayer.
In order to aid in the process, the Gary Plan was introduced. It had a new organizational scheme in which different subjects would be taught by different departments. Similar to the breaking down of factory jobs under Taylorism, students would be herded from classroom to classroom in order to digest a stream of standardized factual information. Like Pavlov's dogs, they would do so at the ring of a bell.
Children go a-sailing.
Confusion.
The first lesson I saw was the terrible confusion that's in any school as people race about at bell-marked intervals. The time-honored experience of mental development is that it occurs with strong concentration, not with fragmented attention.
Class position.
You will not find the doctor's son, however ignorant he is, in the class with the marginalized kids.
Indifference.
Indifference is wonderful. This is a factory to create indifference to intellectual things, to ideas. They have to be whipped, ordered, and disciplined to do anything. Or, just as bad, they have to be offered bribes to do it.
Emotional dependency.
Sure. Probably half of the 60 million kids who attend school in the United States, removed from their own families at a very vulnerable age, become emotionally dependent on a pat on the head, a smile, avoiding an insult.
Intellectual dependency.
In spite of rhetoric to the contrary, a teacher's nightmare is invested in those kids, if any, who actually have learned how to think for themselves. The teacher's job is not only to convey bits of information that should not be challenged, but also to convey how you connect those bits of information, but not practice in doing that for yourself. You memorize someone else's connection.
What is a circle? Billy Henlow.
A circle is a closed curve in which all endpoints on the circumference are equally distanced from the center points.
Very good.
Provisional self-esteem.
Provisional self-esteem, this really ties into the grades, the test scores, the signs of approval by the teacher. You're allowed to feel good about yourself if an authority issues a signal that you can do that. On the other hand, if the authority condemns you, the only way you can feel good about yourself is to become an outlaw.
Alfie Cohn, educational theorist.
What are we trying to do? If our goal is to help kids become critical thinkers, lifelong learners who really enjoy thinking and reading and playing with numbers and ideas, If we want to help them become good learners and good people who can create and sustain a functioning democracy, then education would look very different from the way it looks right now, at least in our culture. We would have to question the use of grades. What research finds is that when kids are trying to get good grades in school, three things tend to happen. They begin to lose interest in the learning itself. Now the purpose is just to get a good grade, rather than to engage with the question or problem at hand. Second, they tend to think less deeply and retain knowledge for a shorter period of time compared to kids who don't have any grades. And third, they tend to pick the easiest possible tasks. That's not because they're being lazy, it's because they're being rational. If we tell kids we want to see a better report card, we want to see higher grades, naturally they'll pick the shortest book or the easiest project because that maximizes the chance of achieving that goal. So regardless of what your goal is, if you're interested in assessing kids and teachers and schools to see are we doing a good job here, you would never need tests in order to see whether kids are learning and where they need help, and you would never need grades to report the results of the evaluation we place on those assessments. We would certainly do away with standardized testing, the kind of testing used in particular states or provinces where everyone takes the same test and then you compare everyone's scores. These tests tend to measure what matters least. It tends to be a good marker for family income, because what standardized tests mostly measure is the size of the houses near a school. But it's the case that some of our deepest thinking kids just don't do well on tests. And some kids who get great scores have never had an original idea in their lives.
Well, I thought you just judged by tests.
Oh, no. There are many other things besides tests that we use. Of course, we do consider a child's general ability and the way he scores on standardized tests, but that's not all.
Competition builds character. In fact, what we find is that by any reasonable notion of character in terms of psychological health or self-esteem, that competition undermines that and creates a kind of neurosis, because we come to think of ourselves as good and competent only to the extent that we have defeated other people. And so we're always playing this desperate king of the mountain game, where we're all worried about triumphing over other people and stepping on their faces and looking at them as if they're going to step on our faces. That has two effects. One is it's horrible for us in terms of psychological development, because there's a perpetual sense of disease and anxiety. But second, it very logically has a destructive effect on our relationships. We compete because we're raised that way, not because we're born that way. I mean, take, for example, the belief in survival of the fittest, which is seen as a Darwinian notion. In fact, Charles Darwin never even used the phrase survival of the fittest. That was coined by a right-wing social thinker in the 19th century named Herbert Spencer, who tried to corrupt Darwin's thinking to his own reactionary political purposes. What Darwin talked about was natural selection, which means that the individual organism that's best able to adapt to a changing environment is more likely to be around to survive and reproduce. But that doesn't specify competition as a mechanism. In fact, often the active avoidance of competition, if not the deliberate pursuit of cooperative strategies, turns out to make it more likely that organisms and entire species will survive. The research consistently shows that competition not only isn't necessary for excellence, but tends to impede excellence on most tasks. And the more challenging the task, the more ingenuity, problem-solving skill it requires, the more competition tends to disrupt that achievement. Excellence pulls in one direction, and competition pulls in another. And in fact, another kind of research study corroborates that. If you take a whole bunch of people and give them a task to do, some kind of problem to work out, and half of them are told, see if you can figure out how to do this task. And the other half are told, this is a contest with a prize to whoever wins, whoever does the best job. Study after study after study across cultures, across gender, across ages, find that the people who compete, who have to compete, end up doing an inferior job on that task. At the moment, it appears as though much of what happens in schools in North America is really for the convenience of people who have most of the power. There is, if anything, an act of discouragement of critical questioning. Corporations claim they want kids who are able to think outside the box, but only so far as they're caught within a larger box that works to the advantage of the free market, which means that the market economy, based on competition, based on economic rather than human considerations, ends up controlling the system.
Today, many people assume that antisocial and even violent behavior by young people is a completely natural phenomenon. Yet anthropological studies reveal this to be a myth. Our widespread use of the term juvenile delinquency exposes not only the failure of modern schooling, but of an important concept given expression by the behaviorists. They called it the frustration-aggression hypothesis.
A quote by James Anthony Fowder: fear is the parent of cruelty.
The frustration-aggression hypothesis was an attempt by behaviorists at Yale to combine their own science of behavior with that of the Freudians. Simply put, when people perceive that they are being prevented from achieving just rewards, their frustration is likely to turn to aggression. This study by the behaviorist Hobart Maurer showed that when rats could not achieve their expected reward, they began to take out their frustrations on each other. The scientist notes that two animals which have lost their hold on the pellet, frustration, will be seen to turn on each other, displaced aggression. Similarly, in a 1941 experiment, toys were placed behind a wire screen where children could see but not touch them. When they eventually gained access to the toys, their play became considerably more destructive. On the one hand, human beings are not rats. Armed with the necessary information, we can come to a logical conclusion about who is to blame for our frustrations in life. Rightly or wrongly, we often point the finger squarely back at ourselves. Yet in the hands of politicians and demagogues, frustration aggression can be a potent tool in deflecting anger onto scapegoats.
They want to throw white children and colored children into the melting pot of integration, through out of which will come a conglomerated, a lot of mongrel class of people.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate this. We hate Jews. We hate faggots. And we hate specs.
We kill the faggots. We kill the lesbians. I said, God damn it, we kill them all. Why kill the elder crackers? The old crepit crackers in South Africa. How in the hell you think they got old? They got old oppressing and killing black people.
I'm not going to discuss it. If he says murder gets murdered, if a murderer gets murdered or slain, capital punishment, that's fine with me. Line them up and we'll clean up our nation overnight. Start with the abortionists. Might as well get rid of a few of those beasts.
Michael Savage, talk show host.
I'm so sick of them! I'm so sick of the brainwashing about Islam and Muslims and the Quran! Shove it! Shove it all! I'm sick of it! Get, take the music off. These throwbacks think they're better than you underneath it all, and 90% of them are on welfare. Speak it out at the supermarket. Tell them what you think of Islam. Tell them what you think of Muslims.
Jay Severin, talk show host.
We're talking about illegal immigration. So now, in addition to venereal disease and the other leading exports of Mexico, women with mustaches and VD, now we have swine flu. And when you scoop up some of the world's lowest of primitives in poor Mexico and drop it down in the middle of the United States, poor, without skills, without language, not sure our culture, not sure our hygiene, haven't been vaccinated, look at all the things we take for granted. It's millions of leeches from a primitive country come here to leech off you.
I don't know what happened tonight, and I don't know why.
Also, the gay agenda and Harry Potter.
Pat Robertson, evangelist.
professors, the 101 most dangerous academics in America, and that's just a short list of the 30,000-40,000 of them. They're like termites that have worked into the woodwork of our academic society, and it's just it's appalling.
Howard Zinn, historian.
Scapegoating. And the hope is that by deflecting the anger of people, which might be directed against the system itself, deflecting the anger against these other people, the system would save itself. In the South, the black people became scapegoats, and you directed the anger of white people. Poor white people in the South were the people who joined the Ku Klux Klan. These poor white people might have rebelled against the governments of the South and against the national government, but no, they were told that black people were the source of their problem.
The facility, heavily armed, immediately started shooting everybody.
It was a local man dressed in battle fatigues who declared, "I have killed 1,000, I'm going to kill 1,000 more." 41-year-old James Huberty reportedly walked into the restaurant carrying a semi-automatic rifle and two other weapons, enough ammunition to last 2 hours. Witnesses inside said he fired wildly into the unsuspecting crowd gathered for a quick evening meal. He fired through windows, hitting people in the street. He fired at men, women, children, and babies.
Bullets fly, leaving a local family scared to be in their own home. Tonight, investigators say hate was driving the man who pulled the trigger.
Deputies say last month, someone opened fire on the Hashems because they're Muslim.
And I need to know who hate us that much, who wants us to die.
Authorities in California are urging Jewish schools and temples to stay alert following a shooting at a synagogue in L.A.
The attack happened in the same area of Bushwick where another Hispanic immigrant was killed.
Vera left a food pantry here at his church in Lower Manhattan, carrying his groceries. He biked across the Williamsburg Bridge and into Bushwick, where police say he was allegedly struck in the head, then thrown off his bike as three black males yelled anti-Mexican slurs.
On the left-hand side of your screen, you can see the two attackers shove and punch Jack Price, the openly gay victim, now in a medically induced coma. The attack accelerates, with both suspects flailing their arms at the helpless 49-year-old.
There was utter pandemonium outside the university building as ambulances carted away the injured. Police have now confirmed 14 students dead, all women. Another dozen people were hurt, caught in a rampage that witnesses called a human hunt, with the gunman yelling, "I want women."
Here we must pause for a week. Please come back next week for part 3 of Scott Noble's film, Human Resources. Our thanks to Robin Upton for the radio adaptation. You can find more of Robin's work at his website, unwelcomeguests.com. .net. And you can find more of New World Notes at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you will tune in again next week. Power to the people.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
Yesterday marked the 17th anniversary of the horrible events of 9/11-2001, an event that changed the U.S. and the world. For those of you who listen to this show regularly or who have done your own research, you know that the official story of 9/11 falls apart at any point of entry. I've been sharing evidence to support that over the last 10 years of doing this show. And currently, we have some good news to share about 9/11, and we're going to hear more about that today. But first, I want to say that 9/11 is like the JFK, RFK, and MLK assassinations in that private researchers have proven that the government accounts of these events are not true and have provided the real evidence that indicates what really happened. And in the case of Martin Luther King, there was even a trial that proved that James Earl Ray didn't do it and that various government agencies were involved in it. This is all well documented in a book by attorney William Pepper called The Plot to Kill King. It's all there, solid evidence. But is this ever mentioned by the corporate media or government people or even the controlled alternative media? No. So 9/11 is like that, too. There's mountains of evidence that disprove the official story, and a large body of people around the world know it. But the government and the corporately controlled mainstream media and some foundation-funded alternative media just don't go there. So it's kind of like living in parallel universes. Many of these citizens know that they're being lied to, but the government and the media just keep putting out that official story, even though there's evidence to disprove it. So currently we have two efforts going on to get at the truth of 9/11 and put it on the official record, get an investigation. And we're going to talk about one of those today and the other one next week. The first one is the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and the grand jury petition that they filed on April 10th of 2018 to the federal court in New York City. And you're going to hear about this through an interview done by James Corbett of the Corbett Report with Mick Harrison, the director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and one of the board members. So let's begin with that interview between James Corbett and Mick Harrison. And James Corbett produced this interview on August 30th, 2018.
And today, I'm talking to two people who are both representing the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, which is at Lawyers Committee for 9/11inquiry.org, but that's a ridiculous URL. So I believe the shorter version that will get you to the website is lcfor911.org. lcfor911.org. Let's introduce our guests. We are talking to Mick Harrison, Esquire, the executive director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, who is a public interest attorney, graduated summa cum laude from the University of the District of Columbia School of Law, and he has a national practice focused on cases that involved whistleblower protection, government accountability, corporate fraud, and false claims and dangers to public health or the environment. And we are also joined on the line today via audio by David R. Meiswinkel, Esquire, a criminal defense attorney, retired police officer of 23 years, and a former U.S. Army veteran. First, Mr. Harrison, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, James. Good to be with you.
Yes, and David Meiswinkel, thank you also for joining us today.
Thank you very much, James.
Okay, so let's start this conversation by the obvious question. What is the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry?
Well, James, we are a nonprofit and incorporated entity in Pennsylvania. Our mission is to promote transparency and accountability regarding 9/11. We have a board of directors. David Meiswinkel, my colleague here, is the acting chair. I am vice chair. We have non-lawyers involved as well. And what we're trying to do is to find out more about what happened leading up to 9/11, exactly what happened on 9/11, and what has transpired because of 9/11, and to make that information known to the public, to our elected representatives, and to law enforcement.
Well, I think the listeners of this program will know that there has been a need for 17 years now for proper criminal investigation into the massive criminal attack that took place on September 11th, 2001, and that we have not seen so far in the justice system. But the question then is, what has brought you and the other members of the Lawyers Committee together on this issue? How did you come to join this, and what is the founding purpose of this?
Well, there's a personal aspect and a professional aspect to the answer. Personally, I tripped into this issue. I've been looking at government misconduct and corporate corruption for about 30 years, most of that as a lawyer. And I happened into a meeting with one of the nonprofits I represent and assist, an environmental group, as it happened. And I heard someone say there were bombs placed in the buildings. This was 10 or more years ago. And I said, what are you talking about? Had no idea what they were talking about. And they said, well, David Ray Griffin, as you may know, is a professor of theology who's investigated this, has been talking about his findings publicly. And he has concluded that there was evidence of the use of explosives to bring the Trade Center buildings down on 9/11. And that was news to me. So a long story from there, but I began my own inquiry because that's the sort of thing that I to look at instances of major crimes that have gone unaddressed. And there was a chemist in Bloomington who you may know of, Kevin Ryan, who's been a well-known researcher on this. Happened to be, he was in Bloomington, Indiana, where I live. I went to talk with him, and he educated me on the science. And at that point, I started doing my own investigation. And it's one of those things that the more you look at it, the more you become concerned.
Yes, I've often noted that people's credulity of the story we've been told about September 11th is in exact inverse proportion to their knowledge of that story. So I think your experience will be relatable to a lot of the people out there in the audience. And then the board itself, how did the board come together? What was the time frame for that?
Well, we've been incorporated as the Lawyers Committee for about 2 years. We did that December 2016, I believe. Might have been 2015. I came on not as a founder. The organization was already meeting as a group of lawyers and investigators, not incorporated when I came on. And our mission wasn't fully formed at the time I came on. And we started discussing amongst ourselves our common goals and our common concerns and decided we did need an incorporated not-for-profit to pursue our mission. And so we decided to incorporate in Pennsylvania about 2 years ago. There are a number of folks on the board. Ed Asner, the actor, is on our board. We have Barbara Honegger, an investigator into 9/11, on our board. We have other lawyers on our board. So we're a mixture of folks who have come to the issue from different paths, but we have a common commitment to the mission.
Well, what we are going to be talking about specifically today is the fact that the 9/11 committee, the Lawyers Committee here, is not simply a talking shop. It is actually pursuing legal options with regards to September 11th. And specifically, we're talking about a petition that has been filed. Specifically, reading from the website, it says the nonprofit public interest organization, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, Inc., is filing a petition with the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, formally requesting, pursuant to federal statute, that he present to a special grand jury extensive evidence of thus far unprosecuted federal crimes relating to the destruction of three World Trade Center towers on 9/11. Tell us about this petition, the grand jury, what it is you're seeking to accomplish here.
Well, we are, as you say, an organization focused on action, not on just talking. We did file this petition you described with the U.S. Attorney in New York. We did that on April 10th of this year. We filed an amended petition July 30th of this year that very few people know about, which added three additional federal crimes to the petition. The law behind the petition, which few people understand, and when I say few people, I also mean few lawyers understand, is that when a citizen reports a federal crime to the U.S. Attorney, which every citizen has the right to do, the U.S. Attorney has a duty, meaning a mandatory obligation, to pass that evidence on of the crime reported to the grand jury, in this case, meaning a special federal grand jury. Now, most folks think about the U.S. Attorney being a prosecutor, like other prosecutors, that their job is discretionary. They can decide who to prosecute, which laws to enforce, when to enforce them, and so forth. And that is generally true, for better or worse, but not true in this particular instance, because this particular federal law says that once the evidence of the crime is passed on to the U.S. attorney, it must be given to the special grand jury. So it's that law that we're using, and that's the short version of why we expect success on this particular objective, the objective being to get this evidence in the hands of, you know, 12 to 23 normal people and let them see if they think the crime has been committed.
That does sound impressive, but I say that as a layman, and not only as any layman, but a Canadian in Japan. So I do not know the ins and outs of grand juries and how they work in the United States. I know a lot of my listeners are in the same boat. Even, of course, a lot of Americans don't know really how this works. Can you break it down for us? What kind of body is a grand jury? How is it convened? How is it appointed? Who appoints it? And how many members does it have? What kind of investigative powers does it have? And what does it ultimately do? What is its final action in the end?
Some real good questions. And again, the grand jury is not well understood by most folks. One reason for that is grand jury proceedings are done in secret by law. The grand jurors are not allowed to talk about the testimony they receive or their deliberations. Now, a witness who comes to a grand jury is allowed to talk about what they testified about if they choose, but the grand jurors cannot. So there are 12 to 23 normal people, normal meaning they're picked from the rolls of registered voters. They are picked in a way that petite or regular juries are picked. A court will go through a selection process. The federal prosecutor is involved. The U.S. attorney is involved in that process. But once they're selected, they act as a normal jury would act on the issues of federal crimes that may have been committed, I emphasize may have been committed, in their jurisdiction within the statute of limitations for the time leading up to and including the time that they sit. Now, they sit for a maximum of 18 months, a year and a half, and then a new jury is appointed. The special grand jury, which we're talking about, has some powers that at least some lawyers think go beyond the regular grand jury's powers. And one of those powers, which is of interest to us, is that a special grand jury, when investigating a potential federal crime, may look at evidence of government misconduct, malfeasance, misfeasance, nonfeasance, even if they ultimately determine no federal crime was committed and no indictment is forthcoming. They can still issue a report on the government malfeasance, misfeasance, or nonfeasance to the court, and the court then publish it. So we would like the special grand jury, in addition to looking at the crimes that we're alleging, to also look at this broader issue.
Just to clarify, the secrecy that surrounds the grand jury's actual proceedings is that is complete and total. It continues after the grand jury has finished its work?
No, not in every respect. If the grand jury returns a proposed indictment and the U.S. attorney signs it, and there becomes a prosecution as a result, that is a public process. The indictment will be public. The findings of the grand jury in that indictment will be public. The particular deliberations that brought the grand jury to do that will not be public. Now, there is an exception, and in most cases in law, there are exceptions. And the federal rules of criminal procedure allow a judge to order a lifting of the secrecy on the grand jury proceedings themselves if there is a need that cannot be met any other way. And I won't get into the ins and outs of that. It isn't done very often, but it is done sometimes.
So the petition, as amended in, as you say, in June, does present evidence of specific crimes that are alleged to have been committed. What crimes are actually being proposed as having been committed here?
Well, the obvious one is bombing of a building, place of public use, in this case for terroristic purposes, so it falls under the terrorism statutes. The second crime is the killing of a federal official. Some folks don't know that there were at least two federal officials killed in New York City during the collapse of the buildings. One Secret Service agent, I believe, and one FBI agent. So that law applies. Aiding, I won't say this exactly as a quote, but providing material support to a terrorist or a terrorist organization is another aspect of this that is alleged in our petition as a federal crime. The fourth crime, maybe the destruction of a federal facility, but I'll have to look that up. There were, you may or may not realize, there were federal offices in some of these Trade Center buildings, CIA, FBI, Secret Service, and so forth. So that's the gist of what we're talking about.
And that's important because this is under federal statute that this grand jury is convened, and therefore federal crimes are at issue here.
That's precisely correct, and only federal crimes. We are not looking at state crimes for this action. There are state crimes involved. We're not looking at them for this particular crime.
Okay. I will at this point, of course, refer people to the petition itself, which is available for download through your website, and I will include the link in the show notes at CorbettReport.com so people can take a look at it for themselves, and I suggest they do so. But in summary, let's talk about the actual evidence that is presented in the exhibits that accompany this petition.
Sure.
Tell us what the nature of these exhibits and what they tell us about the crime of 9/11.
Well, let me give you some examples. There are about 20 categories of evidence that are listed in the petition. Some of these categories are scientific evidence, such as the findings of what we call the red flakes, the thermite, nanothermite flakes in the dust of the World Trade Center. And we attach a report from chemists who analyzed those dust residues, found the flakes. Some of them were still active, meaning they could be ignited. They were determined to have the components of a high-tech nanothermite or nanothermite material, which is a high-tech incendiary, which can be configured as an explosive as well. Now, so we have that finding, which is surprising, to find high-tech explosive residue in the dust. We have eyewitness testimonies. Now, one category of that is more than 100 firefighters and first responders. And a lot of people don't know, but you can find this out by going to the New York Times, which has published these interviews with the firefighters. And these interviews were done by the Fire Department of New York, their official interviews. The interviews show that a number of these firefighters witnessed, saw, and heard the sights and sounds of explosions. And we quoted their testimonies in the petition, very explicit, what you would expect someone to say that they heard and saw if there were actually explosives going off at the time. And some of them even say this looked like commercial controlled demolition I've seen on television. Some of the firefighters actually said that. So you've got explosives found in the residue. You've got professional eyewitnesses saying they heard and saw explosions. You've got video showing the collapse of the buildings. And if you watch those videos carefully, and a lot of folks probably choose not to for understandable reasons, but if you do, and it's a tough thing to watch, every time you see it, it's a tough thing to watch. But you can see that the concrete is being pulverized before it hits the ground. Okay, you can see a relatively, not completely, but relatively symmetric collapse. Building 7 is the extreme example of that. A lot of folks don't know Building 7 collapsed, but it was not hit by a plane, but it did collapse as well later in the day. So you've got this symmetric collapse. You've got a rapid collapse that is near free fall for the towers, and for Building 7 is actual free fall for part of the collapse. Free fall meaning acceleration at the rate of gravity. Now, the only way that happens is if there's no resistance in the floors below the collapsing floors above. Otherwise, the collapsing floors above would hit the intact floors below, encounter resistance, and be slowed, if not stopped. So that is a piece of evidence that's hard to explain. In fact, it's physically, scientifically impossible to explain absent the use of explosives. So you've got these categories. There were also lay witnesses who worked in the buildings, who survived, who testify about seeing and hearing sights and sounds of explosions, some of them injured by those explosions. You've got seismic evidence. We have a professional seismologist who issued a study on this, Dr. Rousseau, and his conclusions were that there were seismic signals caused by explosions at the Trade Center that occurred before the airplane struck the building. So that's a significant piece of evidence standing on its own. There's evidence about the corrosion of the metal, showing like sulfur attacks on the steel. That wouldn't happen in a normal fire. You've got extreme temperatures, extreme meaning well above fire temperature from jet fuel or building contents. So, and I could go down the list, but when you put these pieces of evidence together, as we conclude in the petition, as disturbing as it is, there is no other explanation for this body of evidence. You might be able to somehow say, oh, someone made a mistake on this piece or that piece, or, 100 firefighters were wrong, or the chemist got it wrong in the laboratory, or somehow the video was tampered with to show a faster collapse than actually happened. You have to create some pretty extensive explanations for a number of pieces of evidence to try to get past this conclusion. And, if you actually try to do that, it would show, I think, a considerable bias by the person trying to do that. If you just look at the evidence objectively, this evidence is well beyond the evidence used to indict folks for crimes or to even convict them for crimes. So we have reached that conclusion on the issue, and I focus on this, on the issue of the demolition of the Trade Center building. We have not gone into other issues in this petition. It is focused on the destruction of the buildings only. We are investigating other aspects of 9/11, but this petition is on just this one.
So you talk, for example, about the eyewitness testimony and the different categories of that. And the firefighters' eyewitness testimony, as you say, is a vast repository of very valuable information, firsthand data about what was going on in the buildings that day. And Dr. Gray McQueen, I know, has written a paper about that for the Journal of 9/11 Studies that I would refer my listeners to if they're not familiar with that. Again, quite persuasive firsthand testimony. But I want to focus on one particular firsthand testimony, the testimony of William Rodriguez that you include. Can you tell people who don't know about the story of William Rodriguez and what he had to report about what happened that day?
Well, I can't tell it with the level of articulateness that Willie would tell it. So Willie was a custodian in the building. He had keys to the various floors and the doors. He was there on 9/11 in the lower floors, the sub-level, and I don't know, you know, how to name them precisely, but one of the basement levels. He experienced an explosion below him on 9/11, which was not coming from where the planes hit and happened in his testimony before the plane hit the building he was in. That is hard to explain unless you look at the other categories of evidence in our petition, and then it's not hard to explain. It is one of those pieces that corroborates the other pieces, and those pieces all say, as Willie has concluded himself, there must have been bombs, explosives in the building. They went off, and they hurt a lot of people. They damaged the building, and eventually they caused the buildings to come down. Now, he has a very heroic story of how he helped the firefighters get up into some of the higher floors and rescue people. That's not something he had to do. He could have simply escaped with his colleagues. And so I think we all admire him for that.
Yes, and it's a particularly interesting and persuasive testimony because William Rodriguez is and has been hailed as one of the heroes of 9/11, helping to get many of the people out of the building that day, and has been decorated for that and awarded for his work that day. And his testimony has been consistent since the time of 9/11 itself. He has continued to say that same story, but oddly, that part of the story has not gotten anything like the press coverage of just the man who helped save a lot of people from the World Trade Center. So it is important to get that testimony out and in a court environment where if something can be done about it. I guess, again, I will refer people back to the petition itself so they can actually look at these exhibits and the evidence that's presented there. But as you say, it is a persuasive, overwhelming body of evidence that together points to, obviously, something very different than what we have been told in the NIST's report on the Twin Towers and on World Trade Center Building 7. The question then is, if the grand jury is similarly convinced that there is certainly something here, what would their next step be if, I know this is quite theoretical, if the grand jury is convened and if they are persuaded by the evidence, then they refer it to the court for prosecution?
Well, yes, by way of the U.S. attorney. So if the grand jury is convinced, they ask the U.S. attorney to help them draft a proposed indictment. If the U.S. attorney refuses to do that, and I would hope that that wouldn't happen, the grand jury can do their best to draft it themselves. One way or the other, it can be submitted to the court. Typically, it is not prosecuted unless the U.S. attorney signs it. There is probably some dispute in the legal community about what happens if a grand jury wants an indictment returned and the U.S. attorney refuses to sign it. And there are constitutional issues involved, historical issues about why we have grand juries, and some folks don't know. The grand jury is independent of all branches of government. It's not part of the judiciary. It's not part of the executive branch. It's not part of the legislative branch. It's its own constitutional entity, free of all those other branches of government. And the grand jury, you asked me before, you know, what powers do they have to investigate? They can subpoena witnesses. They can subpoena documents. They can offer witnesses immunity. They can work with a U.S. attorney to make a plea deal to try to get one witness to cooperate against another. Those are all powers that we don't have as, you know, civilian litigators. We might be able to get some subpoena power in a given civil case, but generally they've got a lot more power to unravel this than we do, which is why we want them to look at it. So if they do, and they return the indictment and the U.S. attorney signs it, which would be the normal course, the U.S. attorney would then bring a criminal action in federal court. One or more defendants would be identified and arrested, and then subjected to a criminal trial where they would be allowed to defend themselves, presumed innocent as any criminal defendant. And if the prosecutor met his or her burden to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then there would be a conviction on a 9/11 crime.
And if in the course of the grand jury's investigation they find evidence of another or different federal crime than the one that has been put before them, are they able to continue pursuing that crime, or would they be simply limited to referring that back to the district attorney?
The grand jury is free to pursue any crime that comes to its attention any way, including by its own devices. So the answer is yes, they could pursue any crime that comes to their attention, even if they believe they've discovered it themselves.
Very interesting, and potentially a very powerful tool for getting at the truth of this event. So extremely interesting. But, of course, the other question is, as we talked about at the beginning, you have filed this petition under a federal statute which mandates the district attorney to put this evidence before a grand jury. The question is, A, has that occurred yet? And B, if it has not, what will be the next step for you to seek redress?
Well, that's an important question. The U.S. attorney has not yet disclosed to us what they're doing in terms of acting on our petition. We're hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst. So the best would be that they've already given this information to a grand jury and that they're proceeding in secret on it. We would hope they would give us the courtesy of telling us that that process has been initiated and that our petition has been given to the grand jury. We have not been told that. We are waiting what we consider to be a reasonable time before we take the next step. As I said, assuming the best but preparing for the worst, the worst would be that either the U.S. attorney calls and says, we're not going to do anything on this, we're not going to give your evidence to the grand jury, or they simply don't talk to us at all. In that case, we're going to assume that they're not presenting it to the grand jury because we have nothing else to assume. So in that case, we are prepared to file a federal lawsuit in a federal court to have a court order the U.S. attorney to do its duty on this particular matter and hand our petition evidence to a special federal grand jury. We believe that under the mandamus statute, which is a federal law, a lot of folks don't know about this, but there is a federal law, believe it or not, that says any citizen, at least any citizen with standing, there are some ins and outs on standing, maybe more than there should be, but any citizen with standing can bring an action against a federal official or agency to force that federal official to do their job if and only if that job, that task, is mandatory, not discretionary. So that's why they call it mandamus. Mandatory duties can be enforced, and we have every intention of doing that if worse comes to worse.
Now, you do say that you're allowing a reasonable time, so I assume that the federal statute under which you're filing this petition does not actually give a time limit for the district attorney to act on this or any sort of mandated mechanism by which the information that this grand jury has been convened will be communicated to the public?
I'm sorry to say that you're entirely correct. There is no deadline in the statute other than a reasonable time, which is implied. At least we believe the federal court would imply that. And the statute doesn't really say that the U.S. attorney has to call up the petitioner and give them a status report. But what it does say is that the U.S. attorney must hand the evidence over to the special grand jury and inform the grand jury itself of who presented the evidence to the U.S. attorney. So the U.S. attorney should not only give our evidence to the grand jury, but to say the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry gave this to us, here's our contact information, and the grand jury itself could contact us.
Well, I know that I have a large listener base that is highly motivated on this issue and would like to support people who are doing things like this. In what way can they support the Lawyers Committee in this petition?
Well, we're a nonprofit. We need the same things that any public interest nonprofit needs. We need volunteers, we need donations, we need information. So if any of your listeners have any of those things to spare, money, time, or if they have information on this issue, we would ask that they go to our webpage, www.lcfor911.org. You can sign up there to support our petition to the U.S. attorney. You can make a donation directly to us in a number of ways. You can agree to serve on one of our investigative committees as a volunteer. You can agree to help us raise money as a volunteer. You can do almost anything that an organization could use help on. You know, you can do web research. You can do freedom of information requests. Work with our FOIA committee. We have a number of freedom of information requests out there on some very interesting topics. So we can use all of that help.
And again, you were just listening to an August 30th, 2018 interview with James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com and Mick Harrison, the director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. And their website is lcfor911.org. And again, that website is lcfor911.org. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We're headed to Belews Lake, North Carolina, right beside the Duke Energy Plant, the smokestacks spewing coal ash amidst this otherwise bucolic landscape, where we listened to former Vice President Al Gore, brought there by the Reverend Dr. William Barber and his Poor People's Campaign to highlight one of the four pillars of the Poor People's Campaign, ecological devastation, which is inextricably linked to the perpetuation of poverty.
Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign is an effort by faith and moral leaders to carry forward Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of a Poor People's Campaign, working across the country to alleviate the triad forces of poverty, militarism, and racism that Dr. King knew were poisoning the country and then still are threatening us today.
Let's listen.
The most important thing is that we hear from the people today. So we're going to have people who are going to testify about what is going on, because that is the most important thing that we hear from the people. I want to encourage you before these cameras, and I know it's hard, but if it's all right, there's no need for them to be here.
That's right.
Tell the pain. Tell the nation what's going on underneath all the beautiful skies and all, what the truth is, because only the truth sets us free. So at this time, Tracy Edwards.
I am one of those that live here and have lived here for over 40 years, ever since Duke Energy has been in operation. We've had a lot of health issues, a lot of economical issues as far as not being able to get things done in our community because they are hindering our progress. But we also have a lot of issues as far as not being able to come to terms with what to do about our drinking water. They poisoned our drinking water. They made a lot of people sick. They're not ready to admit what they've done. But a lot of health effects have happened to our community that they're not willing to go ahead and profess their guilt. We will continue to fight these issues. We will continue to vote out the politicians that do not agree with what we're doing because they know it's not right. It's all about money and power. I still say they're Goliath, and we're still David's with a rock.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you.
Alfred Warren.
We need to make sure that no community is left to suffer the coal ash contamination. All the people, regardless of race, creed, or social, economic class, we have the right to a healthy community, clean air, and clean water.
Yes, sir.
We know that living in a close proximity to coal ash impoundment infringes upon the basic civil rights of all. We need more transparency in the process of the coal ash cleanup. Yes. Press our decision makers to make sure that they are open and honest about the health effects of coal ash contamination. Whenever a decision regarding coal ash cleanup are made, it's time for community leaders, members, and experts to be invited by the community to have input. That Duke Energy take full responsibility to be held accountable for past, present, and future contributions that they have made to coal ash, the tragic situation, and contamination of neighborhood drinking water. My name is Alfred Warren. I've lived here all of my life for 63 years. I live within the community. I know directly how it affects the help of our whole entire community. Uh-huh. I speak on the behalf of all the ones that have lost their lives and went on before us.
Yeah. That's right.
God have brought this unity together.
Yeah.
That's what we need. This is not a black thing. That's this right. is not a white thing.
All right.
This is not an economical thing. It's a God thing.
Yeah.
In love, in unity, yeah. we can come together and make a change and make a difference to clean it up.
Clean it up. Clean it up.
Clean it up.
Clean it up. Clean it up. Clean it up. Clean it up.
Thank you.
Clean it up. Clean it up. Clean it up. Leslie Brewer.
And children. Three of my five. This is real. This is very real for me and my family. I have five children. Three are here today. Two are adults working elsewhere. My name is Leslie Bray Brewer. I'm a former high school English teacher. I'm a former editor of this county's newspaper. But before I was all of that, I grew up within the shadow of that steam station. I was so close I could hear the workers talking on the loudspeaker as I played in my yard. Wow. Nobody told us not to eat the fish from the lake. Nobody told me my air was polluted. I noticed the sky was a little different color, but nobody told me the problems. Nobody told us that our vegetables in the ground were imbibing the coal ash. We knew every morning when we got up, we had to go wipe off our cars before we could drive them because there was such a thick layer of coal ash on our vehicles. And then I grew up and I escaped. I said, I got to get out of here. My grandparents were poor sharecroppers. I'm white, but we were poor people, sharecroppers, who saved enough money to buy a farm, we thought, in a wonderful place. But guess what? It was a place where land was cheap because minorities and poorer white right. people lived here. That's so right. big well, companies right. knew they could come here and take advantage right. of people like us.
Yes. Yeah.
So my grandparents ended up dying of lung diseases, emphysema, neurological issues way too soon. I raised, when I came back and bought my childhood home, I escaped for 13 years but came back, I raised four of my five children in the shadow of that steam station as I was. Mm. And from the first, they experienced severe breathing difficulties, many trips to the hospitals at night to the emergency room. My children had such strange issues that when snowflakes would fall through the air, which you know coal ash was there, whether we could see it or not, when the snowflakes fell and touched my daughter's skin, she'd break out in huge hives just from a snowflake in the sky coming down. So what did I do? I moved away. When this child, my fifth child, shortly after he was born, I moved about 20 minutes away where the air was cleaner. We could drink the water better. And you know what? This is the only one of my children who never had breathing issues, who never had to be rushed to the emergency room to breathe, who had none of those problems. My health improved. In the year 2000, when I still lived here, I was bedridden. I had to go in a wheelchair sometimes when I could get out of bed at all. Strange neurological issues that would make me tick and jerk and not even sleep at night. And no doctor, I went to the doctors, nobody could diagnose it. But my neighbors were having the same problems, mysterious sores, breathing issues, neurological issues. So I knew I wasn't alone. One of us went to a doctor in Greensboro who said, oh, you live over near Cancer Lake, don't you?
Aww.
That's what they told us. But once I moved away and we all moved away, our health improved. I'm here today out of a wheelchair.
Yeah.
My health improved. Now, if I carry bitterness, that's going to kill me quicker than all
that's
this
right.
other stuff. However, I urge Duke Energy, clean this up properly. Don't charge us to clean it up
right.
because it is never, ever wrong to do the right thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah.
There's a thing we say when applause doesn't really fit it, even though I know we're applauding her, is shame.
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 The most hurtful thing I just heard her say was when I moved away, my health got better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's more a place for tears than it is for applause.
Yes, yes.
it is.
Yes.
When I moved away
yes.
from my home,
yes.
that's when I got well.
Amen.
Because in my home,
mm-hmm.
people did that for greed mm-hmm. that made me sick.
Right.
You all hear the saying, every child but that one,
yes.
because she moved away.
Mm-hmm.
How many of y'all tired of having to move away?
Yes.
Yes. Right. Now,
it's time to clean away. This place.
Yeah.
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 Good job. Clean it up.
Clean it up.
Same thing.
Clean it
up. I'm going to make a quick few comments and bring on our brother. And I've been saying that our brother, Al Gore. And I want to make sure, I always check around and make sure the audience is real diverse. Because in the South, I'm tired of people splitting us.
That's right.
And I know that if we make issues moral issues and not
red or blue or right or left, but moral issues, we can hold together in the moral center.
Yes. That's right.
Amen.
There are 140 million poor people and low-income people in this country today.
Shame.
The majority of them are women, children, and the disabled. The majority of them in raw numbers are white. The majority's percentage of race are black and Latino. There are 14 million poor children in this country today.
Shame.
There are 13 million households today that cannot afford water.
Yeah, shame.
And the poor are the brunt of climate change effects.
Yes.
Shame.
There are 4 million families in the country today that cannot afford and cannot get, they can buy unleaded gas and can't buy unleaded water.
Shame.
They go right down the street and buy unleaded glass, but they can't purchase unleaded water because the water has been poisoned by corporate greed.
Shame.
And all of these places where you have these coal ash spills and other environmental injustices are in what we used to call was that least undesirable land use, Lulus. Lulus, that's the term they came up with. It means the places where they count on the poor people not either having the power to fight back or that they can go in and fool black and white people to be against each other on other issues so that they won't come together and change the politics of their area. In North Carolina, there are 1 million people uninsured. And yet your legislators from this county have refused to support expanding health care. We're in a state where we have denied expanding health care over 500,000 people, 30,000 veterans. I want you to understand there's some politicians, and you can, it's not about party, but they have some mean politics.
Shame.
I don't care how nice they do it within the rules of Robert's order.
That's right.
When they finish at the end of the day, it's just mean.
Mean.
32% of all the census tracts in North Carolina are at risk for being unable to afford water. Almost 44,000 tons of toxins or carbons are annually emitted in North Carolina. 43,000 tons. Now, we've said some things about Duke Power. I want to go a little bit deeper.
Go deeper.
Because Duke Power can't do any more than the politicians allow.
That's right. Speak the truth.
Now, I want to ask a question. And this is not about a partisan endorsement. It's about a principled endorsement. Right. It's about raising moral issues. Because I believe if folk ever know the moral issues, they'll know who to vote for. You don't have to tell them.
That's right.
Who is one of your senators from up this way? United States Senator.
Burr.
Richard who?
Burr.
No, the one from up this way. Winston-Salem.
Oh, Burr.
Richard Burr.
Burr.
Has Richard Burr come down here?
Oh, Lord, no.
I'm just asking, because some people might have voted for him because, you know, he's against, you know, voting rights. And, you know, he says he's a Christian. And I'm not saying he isn't. I'm just saying. And he says, no, he don't have to do it. He passes these laws about Latino people. But I want to know, has the U.S. Senator who claims that he wins in Stokes County, has he been here to fix the problem of coal ash?
No.
All right, I'm just saying. Has the other senator been here? Tillis?
No.
Does the state senator live anywhere in this area, like near Eden? What's his name? Phil Berger. He's the leader of the Senate. Have they passed any legislation to clean up what's going on and to stop what's going on and to put some regulations on Duke Power?
No.
How about the guy that's the House Speaker, Tim Moore?
No.
Have they been down here?
No.
So this is my point, brothers and sisters. You all know who the problems are.
That's right.
Now, they do good at splitting people. When they want to run for office, they say, if you elect me, I'll protect the elections because we got election fraud. Yeah. And they lie and tell people they're going to have voter protection when it's nothing but voter suppression. And they make you think that's against black people. But in fact, those same people that vote to suppress the vote to give Duke Power unrestricted power.
That's right.
Shame. The same people that have denied health care and told us that it was Obamacare, not the Affordable Care Act,
that's right.
And made us think that it was just, you know, some black and brown people that were being lazy. That were, No. Hundreds of people in this county would be getting health care if we hadn't denied it.
That's
and
right.
The same people.
Yes.
I want us to hear that.
Yes.
When they come in this community and tell you, I'm not for same-sex marriage, vote for me. And people get all hyped up about
right.
something that Jesus
yeah.
didn't even make an issue.
That's true.
Right.
And people vote for them for that issue. Well, the same people that attack the LGBT community are allowing your water to be poisoned.
That's right. Yeah. Come on.
And in the moral constructs of Jesus, to hurt the stranger, to not give people clean water when they're thirsty, is the real sin.
That's right. That's right.
That's the real sin.
That's the sin.
And so I'm asking you all to do a deep dive.
Deep dive.
I'm asking you to call the people in. Mm. Now, they're going to give you some rhetoric, or we'll fix it next time. Mm. Somebody said, you've been around here 40 years.
That's right.
I want to suggest some of you all might need to run. I'm just saying.
That's right.
We have to hold the politicians accountable, and you're going to have to go to them and say, show me the legislation that you passed to protect the people of this area. And when they tell you, well, we couldn't get the votes, well, if you can get the votes to suppress the vote,
that's right.
You can get the vote to change our Constitution.
Yes.
If you can get the vote against gay people, if you can get the vote against health care, if you can get the vote to cut money for public education,
yes.
if you can get the vote to cut taxes for the wealthy and make the poor and the working poor have to pay more, then you can get the votes to protect
right.
our environment and protect
yeah.
our water.
Yeah.
It's a matter of will, and it's a matter of moral direction.
That's
yeah.
right.
Moral direction.
Come on. What
yeah.
The problem is here that we have a situation. We are no longer pushing mm-hmm. our politicians on moral issues, and they skate through on partisanism.
Yes.
And so this election, hold folk accountable.
Yes.
That's right.
Next election, hold folk accountable.
Yes. That's right.
If your senator won't clean up the coal ash, go get bottles of water with it in it and take it to their office in Raleigh. Like the farmers did down east one time when
That's
they took
right.
the sewage. But we know we can fix this.
Yeah.
Tomorrow,
yeah.
Monday, Tuesday, they could pass, they could have a special session and pass the legislation to make Duke Energy have to clean this up on their own money and not charge you anymore.
That's right.
Tomorrow, not 2 weeks from now, they could have a session to halt pop lines. Tomorrow,
That's
they could
right.
decide that North Carolina is going to focus on solar energy
yes.
and renewable energy.
Yes.
It is immediately within the possibility of chance and change.
Yes.
All right.
But it's only going to happen
mm-hmm.
if you decide you will no longer split us, especially in the South.
Amen.
Yes.
I personally, as a son of the South, and as I bring on another son of the South, who is a former vice president, but a tremendous and leading voice in this area,
Amen.
I'm about sick of people dumping on poor folk in the South.
That's right.
Amen.
I'm about sick of people using race to split black and white people.
Amen.
When they end up passing policies that hurt us all.
Yes.
Denying living wages hurts us all. Denying health care hurts us all. Immigrants hurting other immigrants hurts us all. And poisoning our water hurts us all. Well, it's time for us to say, North Carolina, we are drinking from a new well. We are drinking from the well of justice, the well of love, the well of mercy. And that new water is like living water, and it's bubbling up in our spirits, and it's even got a hold of our brother Al Gore from Tennessee. God bless you. Welcome to former Vice President.
Thank you, Reverend Barber, and it's an honor for me to be here, and it's a joy to be here with my daughter, Corinna, my friend Catherine Flowers from Alabama, and it's been so enlightening to me to hear from the local residents and those who have suffered the consequences of being exposed over the long term to this coal ash, and it's tragic when we hear about the health consequences, but it's inspiring when we feel their determination to solve this and to demand that this problem be solved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Frederick Douglass once wrote that power never concedes anything without a demand. What you're hearing today is a demand
yes.
from this community.
Yes.
Yes.
I've spent most of my life since I left the White House involuntarily, and fighting for solutions to the climate crisis.
Oh, wow.
And there are solutions. But I want to draw connections between Blues Lake and the coal ash pollution and the gaseous pollution that is threatening to make up our entire planet the kind of mess that they've made here. We had to stop for on the way over here for, or actually we didn't stop, but we saw going beside us all these train cars full of coal. On a peak day, this plant over here burns 220 rail cars full of coal. And what is left over when they burn it is this toxic coal ash. Now, if you had all these millions of tons of a toxic substance and you just dug a raw gash in the ground and dumped it in there, you would be behaving recklessly.
That's right.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah. That's right.
This is a crime scene.
Yes.
They ought to call this event CSI Blues Lake. This is a crime scene investigation.
It is. Yes, it is.
Now, where'd those train cars full of coal come from? They came from the north and slightly northwest. The big coal baron that has one of the least responsible coal mining operations up there in West Virginia. And he hired a lobbyist and went to the new administration right after this new administration was put in place. And he gave a letter to the new president. And the number one demand on the polluters' part on that list was to loosen up the restrictions and regulations on dumping coal ash. That lobbyist who went in with him to see one of the cabinet members just became the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. And the very first act he took as head of the EPA was to follow through on the demand of his former employer just months earlier to loosen up the regulations on the treatment and disposal of coal ash. You can look it up. It's right there in the record. What do they want to loosen up? Well, they don't want the same monitoring of whether or not it's going into the drinking water.
That's right.
And these health consequences that we have heard about from those who have lived in the shadow of this Duke Energy coal plant, they come from, the doctors believe, the exposure to these toxic chemicals. Sometimes it's difficult to connect all the dots, but when so many people in the same area suffer the same consequences, it's fair to say, well, we believe we know here at CSI Blues Lake what the villain is. Now, I want to make another connection for you. When they burn all that coal and produce the coal ash, they have another waste stream, and you can see it right there. Going out the stacks.
Yes, sir.
On an annual basis, there's 110 million tons of coal ash produced in this country every single year. On a daily basis, there's 110 million tons of man-made heat-trapping global warming pollution put into the atmosphere every single day, as if the atmosphere is an open sewer for them to use free of charge so they do not have to take responsibility for the pollution they're causing. Now, what are the consequences here at CSI Blues Lake of all that pollution going into the air? Well, every night on the television news is like a nature hike through the book of Revelations these days.
Yes.
Have you seen the fires in California?
Yes.
The biggest ever. And throughout many regions of the American West. And in places like Sweden, north of the Arctic Circle. Yeah. And in Mongolia. And in Greece. Yeah. And in Africa. I go Australia. Yeah. They've got one of the worst droughts they've ever had. Because we're trapping all this extra heat that global warming pollution traps in the atmosphere, and it raises the temperature to record high levels. Some of the places in the world that are already hot are getting so hot people feel like they can't live there anymore, and some of them are becoming climate refugees, and they're shaking the political system in Europe, and they're creating problems in many places. It's heating up the oceans, and when you boil the oceans, the steam goes into the air. Boiling is an exaggeration. Let me back up here. When you heat up the oceans too much, the amount of water vapor that goes into the sky increases dramatically. And when it comes over the land, that's what causes what the scientists are calling rain bombs, where you get these unprecedented downpours. Hadn't been too long ago there was a 500-year flood near here. We have these record downpours all over the world. Yes. Last summer in Houston, Texas, they got 5 feet of rain, causing an utter disaster. The ice is melting. The sea level is rising. We're seeing the hurricanes get stronger. Now, all of this is connected to the same system that's producing that global warming pollution and the coal ash that is causing the health problems in this community. We have to change the system. We have to make new decisions about who is going to write the policy and pass the laws.
Yes.
How many people here are registered to vote?
Yes.
Between now and the election, less than 90 days from now, and between now and the election, 2 years and 90 days from now, if you can register more people to vote and take the advice of Reverend William Barber and do not let the polluters and those who are thriving on injustice divide us along the color line, along the poverty line, along the other lines they try to draw to keep people apart. If we come together around a moral center, this is a Moral Monday, and the Moral Mondays movement, which has been started inspiringly by Reverend Barber, has now inspired other church communities and other groups of people all across this country to launch their own Moral Mondays.
Yes.
Now that ecological devastation has been placed along with racism and poverty and militarism at the heart of the cause that Moral Mondays is addressing and that the Poor People's Campaign is addressing, I believe we're going to see this concern for changing this system also spread around this country. I'm inspired by the local citizens who have become activists to protect their families and communities. Thank you for what you're doing. Forward together.
Well, I'm glad that you all are in the fight, and we're in the fight together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we may have to up our ante.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Whenever there is injustice, you might use this somewhere. Whenever there's injustice,
I'm taking notes
okay.
all day.
Whenever there's injustice, you have to have somebody that's willing to create enough turbulence around the injustice that will cause people to question the direction we're going in.
See, Greg, that's what I do.
That's right. The other day, I was on the plane, and the autopilot was set. But then turbulence came up.
All right now.
And when the turbulence came up, it forced the pilot to question the direction in which we were traveling.
Yeah.
If we can create enough justice turbulence and enough love turbulence and enough mercy turbulence and enough truth turbulence, we can cause the politicians of North Carolina and the business leaders of North Carolina to question the direction that we're going. I'm authorizing you today, not in Bob's name, but in the name of the Holy Ghost, to create some turbulence up here in this county, in Raleigh, in Washington, D.C., until we make people question the direction that we're heading in as a nation. God bless you.
Watch all, and I'll be preaching that, y'all.
All right.
Amen.
has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
The headlines read, Secret plan for laws to reject gay students.
The government wants to avoid any controversy that could harm its chances of retaining Wentworth.
Will the Prime Minister join with Labor to ensure that teachers can't be sacked just because of who they are or who they love?
A gay teacher doesn't teach gay maths, they just teach maths.
I said that if we won the seat of Wentworth, it would make history. And my friends, we have made history.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A far-right homophobe leads a pro-queer leftist in Brazil's presidential contest. Uruguay's trans people win identity, health, and job rights. And the queers in schools debate prompts a political power shift in Australia. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 20th, 2018. A far-right presidential candidate in Brazil, whom some describe as the Donald Trump of the tropics, fell just short of winning a 50% majority among a field of 13 candidates in the first round of voting on October 7th. Jair Bolsonaro of the oxymoronically named Social Liberal Party received 46% of the vote and will face the runner-up left-wing candidate Fernando Haddad, who got 29%. Haddad is the Workers' Party candidate endorsed by former President Lula da Silva, who remains a highly popular figure. Haddad replaced da Silva as the party's candidate in September after a court barred da Silva from running for re-election because of his conviction on money laundering and corruption charges. Haddad will need votes from most of those who did not choose Bolsonaro in the first round to overcome the steep deficit.
Their policy positions couldn't be more different. Bolsonaro has implied that women who are raped asked for it and said he would be incapable of loving a homosexual son. Haddad has championed LGBTQ rights and is promising to criminalize homophobia and transphobia. He has condemned Bolsonaro's offensive comments on the rights of women, ethnic minorities, and LGBTQ people, saying that his rival has a psychological problem. But Bolsonaro, a former army officer and longtime lawmaker with an undistinguished record, has also promised to bring hardline military people into his administration to restore law and order to Brazil. He's successfully using fear of the other to rally voters already disgusted by rampant government corruption, a floundering economy, and rising crime rate. One supporter tweeted that, "Today we'll start to make Brazil great again." The runoff election between Bolsonaro and Haddad is scheduled for October 28th.
Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez spoke out against marriage equality this week, but said LGBTQ people should be treated with dignity, no matter what their inclination, and invited all citizens to engage in the debate. "Personally, as a Christian," he told reporters, "I am against the marriage of people of the same sex. Obviously, it is the judiciary that, according to Honduran law, has to pronounce on it." a lawsuit challenging the one man and one woman definition of civil marriage in the Central American nation is pending in its Supreme Court. Perhaps more importantly, as one of almost two dozen nations to sign on to the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights, Honduras is bound by a January ruling of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that ordered all signatory nations in the region that haven't already done so, and that's most of them, to open civil marriage to same-gender couples.
But Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel has declared his support for marriage equality. He took over the presidency from Raúl Castro in April. Castro's daughter, Mariela, has for several years been one of the country's leading proponents of queer equality. During a national television interview in September, Díaz-Canel said that recognizing marriage between two people, without limitations, responds to a problem of eliminating all type of discrimination in society. Cubans will go to the polls in February to vote on a draft constitution approved by the National Assembly to replace the 1976 National Charter, which defines civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The new document includes a provision making marriage gender neutral, thus opening the institution to queer couples.
The island nation's powerful Roman Catholic Church, which claims more than 60% of the Cuban population, is against the change, of course. And leaders of more than 20 different evangelical Cuban Christian denominations are doing more than voicing their opposition. They're collecting signatures on a petition to oppose Article 68 in the draft constitution because it eliminates the one man, one woman definition of marriage. Cuban Evangelical League Church President Alida Leon Baez says she expects more than 500,000 signatures will be gathered in the island nation of almost 12 million people. It's not yet clear what impact the petition might have on the pending February referendum.
Meanwhile, despite the overwhelming approval in an Australian referendum for civil marriage equality, Sydney's Anglican Diocese, the country's largest, is building on its opposition to church weddings of queer couples by adding sacred practices by Indigenous people and even meditative yoga to a list of activities it's refusing to host. The upcoming 51st Synod of the Sydney Diocese will debate the introduction of policies that church-owned buildings, there are reportedly about 900 of them, are used only for acts or practices which conform to the doctrine, tenets, and beliefs of the diocese. The new ban includes advocacy for transgender ideology, e.g. gender fluidity, and advocacy for expressions of human sexuality contrary to our doctrine of marriage. Other activities to be banned on church property include abortion advocacy, traditional Indigenous Australian smoking ceremonies, where the purpose is to cleanse a place from the residual spirits of those who have died, promotion of non-Christian religions or Christian groups whose basis of faith differs from Anglican principles, and even yoga classes that involve spiritual practices derived from Hinduism. Bishop Michael Steed, the major sponsor of the new initiative, said that the principle is simple. Churches should not be compelled to use their property for purposes contrary to their doctrine. Critics are calling the proposals direct attacks on minority Australians, and because the policies would forbid Anglican pastors in Sydney who support marriage equality from expressing that belief, an assault on freedom of speech.
But Uruguay lawmakers have approved a measure to allow trans people to change their gender designation on official documents without a judge's approval. The South American country's lower house, the Congress, approved the legislation on October 18th. The wide-ranging measure, which had already passed in the Senate, also guarantees government-paid reassignment surgery and hormone treatments. In addition, it requires that a minimum of 1% of government jobs be given to trans people during the next 15 years and offers trans people born before December 31, 1975, a monthly pension to compensate for being targeted and persecuted during Uruguay's 12-year military dictatorship that ended in 1985. Formal announcement of passage this week in Congress prompted jubilant cheering from trans advocates who'd packed the galleries for the vote. The new laws take effect immediately.
In other news, police had to use tear gas, concussion grenades, and high-pressure water cannons at the first-ever Pride Parade on October 13th in the eastern Polish city of Lublin. But the targets were a violent crowd of some 300 right-wing extremists who were trying to block the procession. Some of them pelted the police with rocks and bottles before running away. About 1,000 LGBTQ people and their allies then hoisted rainbow flags and banners to joyfully parade undisturbed. The event got final approval only the day before when Lublin's Court of Appeals overruled a ban by Mayor Krzysztof Zuk, who had cited security concerns. Despite frequent opposition from government officials in the deeply conservative, mostly Roman Catholic country, pride marches have also been successfully held in Warsaw and a few other cities.
And queer Jamaicans and their supporters chose a deserted road in Montego Bay this week to march with pride. Jamaica is one of the most dangerous places on the planet to be openly queer. Physical violence against people who are LGBTQ or are perceived to be is routine on the Caribbean island. Walk for Rights organizer and leading Jamaican queer activist Maurice Tomlinson told reporters that the turnout more than doubled the number he expected. At the outset, there was fear, Tomlinson said. We hope to get at least 50 LGBT Jamaicans to bravely walk despite the very real fears that the community feels. However, more than 100 persons showed up. A large police presence guaranteed the safety of what local media described as a well-organized march.
And finally, perhaps because of the male bashing they thought characterized the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, people who say they voted for Donald Trump in 2016 believe that men face far more discrimination in America than LGBTQ people. A survey of 1,500 U.S. adults conducted from October 14th to 16th by The Economist and the polling company YouGov found that nearly one in five Trump voters say that there's a lot of discrimination against men in the U.S., while only 9% agreed that LGBTQ people face much discrimination. They also think that men suffer more discrimination than women, Jews, Hispanic Americans, African Americans, Asian Americans, Arab Americans, and immigrants. People who voted for Hillary Clinton were essentially the mere opposite in their responses. Only 8% said that queer people don't face a lot of discrimination, and less than 1 in 10 thought that men face substantial bias. Peter Boykin, founder of Gays for Trump and a GOP candidate for the North Carolina House of Representatives, agreed with other Trump voters. He told NBC News that the market is more open for people to be of color or gay, and the tables now have turned where it's now hurtful to your personal prosperity to be a plain cisgender white male. Break out your hankies and miniature violins for the poor, put upon white American male.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending October 20th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeCesar, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the always updated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Partisan political upheaval is changing the face of key Western democracies from Europe to the U.S. to the land down under. Australia's parliamentary roller coaster lurched into a religious freedom field curve on queer school kids and teachers, which then careened into the election of an independent lesbian MP to upset new Prime Minister Scott Morrison's balance of power. This Way Out Sydney correspondent Barry McKay has been on the two-week ride and tracked the story's complex interconnections as they unfolded.
After the Marriage Equality Bill was passed into law in Australia after a national vote on the issue last year, many members of the hard right of the governing Conservative, Liberal and National Party coalition were not amused. To appease them, the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, whose politics are more left-leaning, promised a Protections into Religious Freedoms review, which was supposed to be handed down at the end of this year sometime. Malcolm Turnbull considered the introduction of marriage equality one of the many positive reforms he brought in during his time as Prime Minister. The rough-and-tumble dynamics of Australian politics allow a party to stab their leader in the back whilst in office. And in late August this year, Malcolm Turnbull was deposed as leader by his party members. This was brought about mainly by those on the hard right of the coalition due to Turnbull's centre-left stand on issues such as climate change, energy policy, and the introduction of marriage equality. When Malcolm Turnbull was knifed in the back, he decided to quit politics, thereby triggering a by-election in his former seat of Wentworth in Sydney's eastern suburbs. On the 10th of October, the left-leaning Fairfax Press, which publishes the Sydney Morning Herald and Melbourne's Age newspapers, ran with a story purporting to publish leaks from the long-awaited Protections into Religious Freedoms Review. The headlines read, "Secret Plan for Laws to Reject Gay Students." This sent the media abuzz. Even traditionally conservative commentators such as Sky News's Andrew Bolt joined in the chorus of voices calling out the injustice they saw behind this leak to the press.
For 5 months, the federal government sat on a report from its hand-picked panel on how to protect our religious freedom. Today, parts of that report were leaked to the Fairfax media, obviously to hurt the Morrison government ahead of the Wentworth by-election. And what do we read? That we must let religious schools ban children who are gay. That's right. Let them ban students who are gay. Now, of course, those schools should have that freedom. We're a free society, freedom of religion. So, yes, the schools, Christian or Muslim, who want to reject gay students as an abomination can do that. But you know what that report on religious freedom should have added? Any school that does something that mean and that stupid should not get a single dollar of taxpayers' money. These schools are perfectly free to be bigots, but I don't want my taxes subsidising their bigotry. Cut them off. That's my freedom, the freedom not to pay people making life miserable for gay kids.
The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, immediately chimed in.
New laws to discriminate against kids on the basis of sexuality? No way. The fact of the matter is that every child's entitled to human dignity. We shouldn't even be having this debate.
However, the current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, the first Prime Minister to hold office who attends a Christian fundamentalist church, was quick to point out that the law already had provision for religious schools to have the right to refuse LGBTIQ students.
Well, it's the existing law, and we're not proposing to change that law to take away that existing arrangement that exists. We have a report that's been provided to the government. It's a report to government, not from government. It's a report that the government will be considering and developing a balanced response to.
Ironically, that law was extended in the dying days of a previous Gillard Labor government in 2013, before marriage equality became official policy of the Labor Party. On the 10th of October, Mr. Shorten challenged the Prime Minister to release the entire Religious Freedoms Report.
Labor is challenging Mr. Morrison.
From ABC Radio.
If you're not planning anything nasty, reveal the report before the Wentworth by-election. If you're not going to do anything nasty, then be up front with the Australian people. It's an expert report. What could be in that report which is so bad that it has to remain hidden?
The Wentworth by-election will be crucial to the government's smooth running between now and the next election, expected next year, and determine if it holds on to its one-seat majority in Parliament. The electorate includes Sydney's famous Bondi Beach and King's Cross, and despite having some of Sydney's most expensive real estate within its boundaries, it's largely socially progressive and has a large percentage of LGBT voters. The government's main rival in this contest is Dr. Keren Phelps, who is standing as a high-profile independent candidate. She is former president of the Australian Medical Association and is in a lesbian relationship and is well known in the LGBT community.
The government wants to avoid any controversy that could harm its chances of retaining Wentworth.
ABC Radio's PM program on the 15th of October.
Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus suggests that's why the Ruddock Review into Protections for Religious Freedoms hasn't been publicly released yet, despite being finished for months and much of its contents already known.
Why won't the Prime Minister just release it in full and announce the government's response? So the Australian people, including voters in Wentworth, can read the whole report and know what the government is planning to do. What is the Prime Minister hiding?
The Prime Minister has the
Speaker. Well, the answer to the question is nothing, Mr. Speaker.
The Ruddock Review recommended clarifying laws that differ from state to state on whether religious schools can expel gay students. The spotlight on the little-known provisions prompted widespread outrage, including in the seat of Wentworth. The government response was to promise to introduce legislation to remove that exemption from anti-discrimination laws. The opposition agreed and then pushed further, seeking to overturn exemptions that allow religious schools to discriminate against gay teachers too. The Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, was supportive when asked about it on RN Breakfast this morning.
I don't think there's any room for discrimination, be it a student or against a teacher.
Labor was listening.
Does the Prime Minister agree with his Treasurer?
With Bill Shorten asking Scott Morrison twice if he held the same views.
I ask the Prime Minister again. Will the Prime Minister join with Labor to ensure that teachers can't be sacked just because of who they are or who they love?
Scott Morrison is prepared to rush through legislation to protect students where there's no pushback from religious institutions. But when it comes to teachers, there's not the same consensus. So that will be dealt with later, which will be after the by-election in Wentworth this weekend.
And there will be a time and a place to address those issues. And they're important issues. But the issues that we need to address right here and now relate to the children.
On the 12th of October, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison bowed to pressure and promised to bring a law into effect that would ensure that no student is expelled from any religious school on the basis of their sexuality or gender identity. He was not, however, willing to extend this to protecting LGBTIQ teachers from being sacked. The ABC's Catherine Gregory spoke to ABC Radio National's AM program the following day.
So just to give a bit of background, there are currently exemptions in place which do allow religious schools to refuse gay students and teachers. And the review actually recommended to keep this exemption, but also put in conditions around its use, tightening it up, so to speak, making schools be very transparent about any sort of discrimination and ensuring that if they do so, it's in the best interest of the child. So Scott Morrison actually says that the Commonwealth Commission review, which was conducted by Philip Ruddock, was actually about strengthening protections for students from discrimination. Now, he also says that this view that students should not be discriminated against is actually shared across the parliament.
And broadly speaking, Catherine, what's been the response elsewhere so far?
Well, there's been a lot of debate over these proposals, as you can imagine. Very conservative politicians have come out and said that they do actually support the idea of religious schools being able to discriminate on the basis of students and staff sexuality. I've also contacted the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church. I spoke to them late yesterday. They're still really to give their response. I have spoken to other minority faiths who've told me that they're against any proposal to discriminate. And this morning, the Association for the Heads of the Independent Schools in Australia said that they've never seen this exemption used. But overall, there's really no doubt that there's been a lot of public outcry over this issue, and it's somewhat reminiscent of what we saw last year with the same-sex marriage debate. So I imagine a lot more will happen in the next few days.
The following Monday on the ABC's National Open Forum TV program Q&A, Christian Principal Kevin Muslaya of the Red Rock Christian College expressed his views on the hiring of gay teachers. However, he was quickly put to task by Labor politician Terry Butler.
Let me just get to the point, though. If you found that one of your teachers was gay, you didn't know that before, even though they were teaching your religious doctrine, would you want the right to sack them?
It's a case by case. I mean, it's really hard to be able to articulate that. And despite, you know, public criticism around that, the very preface that we are a Christian school, there is a particular alignment of values. And so when that comes into question, we have to ask the thing, how is that having an impact on that value base and how we promote that?
Okay, hang on for one sec. I might come back to you, but I'll just... Terry Butler wants to jump in.
Aren't your values love thy neighbour? And if so, why would you discriminate on the ground of sexuality or gender identity? I mean, a gay teacher doesn't teach gay maths. They just teach maths.
On the 17th of October, 3 days out from the Wentworth by-election, reports surfaced of hundreds of anonymous emails being circulated that candidate Karen Phelps had withdrawn from the election contest, claiming that she had AIDS, and urged the public to vote for the Liberal Party's candidate, Dave Sharma, instead. There was immediate condemnation of the emails from both sides, and at this stage it is not known exactly who was behind the email campaign. Reports had emerged on ABC Radio about 2 weeks earlier how an emerging alt-right movement in Australia was seeking to infiltrate and influence the Australian government. Dr. Phelps made her feelings known on ABC Radio.
It certainly wasn't designed to help my campaign, and for somebody to try to circulate an email widely to say that I was pulling out of the race because I'd been diagnosed with this disease is, you know, quite outrageous.
Liberal candidate for Wentworth, Dave Sharma, has been out and about this morning. He's also responded to the email, saying he was disgusted by its contents.
It's just vile and despicable. I was shocked and appalled by them, not only for the dishonesty and the smears involved, but for the stigma it put around people with HIV/AIDS.
I think it's disgraceful. I think it's outrageous.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison on ABC Radio the same day.
And as Karen herself has said, that she doesn't believe it had anything to do, and I'd be horrified if it did, and it didn't, with the Liberal Party. So, I mean, that is the ugly side of Australian politics, and it has no place in any such contest.
It's now the 20th of October, and it became quite evident early in the evening, after the beginning of counting of the votes, that there had been a large swing against the government and that the electorate of Wentworth had gone to Karen Phelps.
Thank you to the people of Wentworth for placing your trust in me. I won't let you down. Thank you to the love of my life, my beautiful wife, Jackie. Just a few short weeks ago, I was told this was an impossible task, and if we actually managed to win the seat of Wentworth, that it would be a miracle. I said that if we won the seat of Wentworth, it would make history. And my friends, we have made history. What we have done is tapped into a sentiment in the Australian people to talk about the issues that are important to them, not the issues about survival for a particular political party. This victory is for the people in Australia who need a voice. And I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
The Liberal National Coalition government is now a minority government and will have to do some hard bargaining with the crossbench MPs in the House of Representatives to pass legislation. The Protections into Religious Freedoms Review report is yet to be released in full, but the government will now find it harder to get bills through Parliament designed to appeal to the hard right of the coalition. I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Monique Lukens and Michael LeBeau, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Barry McKay. Alice Cooper performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Thanks for helping to keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media and wherever you get your podcasts. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WHRW Binghamton, New York, 6RTR Perth, West Australia, KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In May 1968, students and workers across France brought the country to a standstill. One set of radical ideas that both channeled and influenced the spirit of the times were those of the Situationists and their central thinker, Guy Debord. Debord's book, The Society of the Spectacle, proved massively influential. Joining me to talk about Debord's ideas and whether they have value today is Anselm Yappe. His analysis of Debord's intellectual influences, titled Guy Debord, has been republished by PM Press. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have a connection to PM Press. Yappe is an independent scholar and teaches at the Fine Arts School of Sassari in Sardinia, Italy, and joins me now. Anselm, can you flesh out for us who, in fact, Guy Debord was?
Guy Debord was a very non-typical French intellectual and a kind of artist, or better to say anti-artist, as I can explain better, who was born in 1931 in Paris. And he died in 1994. He committed suicide due to his a disease which is called alcoholic polyneuritis, a very painful illness. So, and he started when he was very young. When he was 20, he started to frequent in Paris the radical avant-garde milieu, which in that time was a lettrist, a small group which tried to retake the spirit and some techniques by the Dadaist movement. But rather quickly he got into contrast with the founder of that movement, the Romanian Isidore Isou. And what he did when he was 20, he presented a film without images, which was called Howls for Sodom. And he always claimed that this film was the most important thing he did in his life. It is naturally also kind of, how do you say, of coquetteering. But it already showed that he really wanted to engage in some kind of radical negation of everything that was that had been art and also of the avant-garde which had existed until that moment. So he founded a little, you cannot really call it an organization, I would say a circle, in international, Lettrist International, with maybe something like not even a dozen of people in Paris, who developed also new kinds of living and of exploring, especially the urban environment, which they call that psychogeography, and the special technique of it was the derive. Derived, that means to go astray all over the city, and to take observations, but also in view of building a newer and a better city. So today there is much interest about these things, especially in art schools and so on. But Debord, quite quickly, he passed on to other things. So he had international contacts, especially with the Danish painter Asger Jorn. So finally led in 1957 to the foundation of the International Situationists. So that was an organization that lasted until 1972. And it must be said only 70 people were members of it, and only maybe 15 really played an important role in it. And there was a lot of splits and of exclusions. In the end, the organization was reduced even to 3 people in 1972. So I think it's interesting to stress that it was such a small group, and it... And on the other hand, it had such a fort impact on the intellectual and partly also on the political history of the second half of the 20th century.
How did the situations end up influencing so significantly the events of May 1968 in France?
So what is really remarkable in the situation is that they wanted to fight what they call the spectacle. It's not only media, but something much broader, without using the spectacular method. So simply de Beau and the other situation is Raoul Van Egem. So they never gave interviews. They never went to television or not even to the radio. And so they didn't teach at the university, so they only stroke, as to say, by their own writings and by some scandals which they organized. So the situation is also a good example of how even very few individuals can really influence the course of things if they have a strategical thinking, if they understand what is happening in society. They also understood it, I think, not only by intellectual reasoning, but also by really living and experiencing in the first person, for example, the transformations of Paris, the transformations of everyday life. On the other hand, de Beau was also a freestyle intellectual who had enormous culture, and especially he was a great writer, and he had a very, very, how do you say, sharply style, very polemical style, so which even today impresses many readers. He could really destroy somebody with just one sentence. So the situation is very quite aggressive group. So they even thought to be more or less the only people who had something new to say. And in the 60s, so they got more and more away from the artists, from the original cultural background, and they also nearly completely renewed also their members. I have to say, de Beau was the only people which was there from the beginning to the end, and he was always a central figure. It was really an international in the sense that there are people from about 10 countries. Also, there was also an American section in the end, before there was a British section. But the center was always in Paris, and the main activity of the group to publish a magazine called International Situationist, it was in French. So but the situation is first had quite little impact on society and on even on French society until, let's say, maybe 66. But then the review got read more and more. They participated. They organized something in 66, which was called the Strasbourg scandal. That means they wrote a brochure against the poverty of student life, which was printed in hundreds and thousands of copies at the dependence of the students' union. So there was also kind of a financial scandal about that. And in that moment, for example, they really showed, especially de Beau, really to have a strategical understanding of what can be said in a certain moment. In 67, de Beau published his most important book, The Society of Spectacle. And Raoul Van Egem, he published another book, which is still read today, the Treatise of How
to Everyday Life.
Yes, I think they changed the title in English. And when 68 came, effectively, the situation is ideas were known not to very, very many people, but they circulated somewhat. So what was the influence of situations about 68 is hard to say. It is true that the different leftist groups like Maoists, Trotskyists, and even traditional anarchists were much more present. But on the other hand, it is sure that situation was much more in tune with the profound meaning of it.
So they channeled the ideas of the moment, the spirit of the moment.
They had no direction about it. So I think nearly all of the participants didn't know about the situation, but there was a kind of profound sympathy. So the 68 movement, especially when it went among student protesters and also meant workers occupying factory and going on strike, it was a kind of confirmations what the situation is said since several years, that there was still a huge potential for protest, but it was not a traditional class struggle anymore, but it was also about housing, it was also about everyday life.
Tell us about the Society of the Spectacle.
Yeah.
When we talk about Guy Debord now, obviously a great deal of time has passed, in fact 51 years since the Society of the Spectacle was published, and yet Du Bois certainly has not disappeared as a figure, but in some ways he's been incorporated into the more established canon because his notion of the spectacle has been narrowly defined as prescient about the rise of celebrity, of mass media. Tell us about what he meant by the spectacle in the Society of the Spectacle and the basis of his critique of capitalism.
Yes, the Society of the Spectacle was published at the end of 67, just a few months before 68, and it was also quickly translated into English, I think, into 70. So it is not a theoretical treatise, but it is something like 220, I think, chapters or sections which come from one phrase. So there's a very, very aphoristic style in it, and the longest of these theses are, I think, something like two or three pages. So it is very apodictic and very aphoristic in its style. There is no sociological jargon, so it is a very classical style. And I think this is also one of the reasons why, at least to me, I think De Boer is, together with Herbert Marcuse, I think the only author we can still read today, and not only for historical reasons, but because it is something which is still present and which is also clear in its language. So what means a spectacle? De Boer clears immediately that media, like television, are only the most superficial part of spectacle. So often, as you said, today De Boer is often credited with having a genial forerunner of the critic of media. So some people said how intelligent he was in 67, when at least in France you only had two television channels in black and white. He already understood it. It is true that he understood the meaning of that, but his idea of spectacle is much larger. Spectacle means every situation where a minority acts and the other are just looking at. So spectacle is also quite close to something like a projective identification. The word spectacle means that in a modern society, people are obliged to make a quite boring, dreary life, especially by being forced to work. And they could make a much more interesting life, especially because overcoming work would be possible also due to technological development. So the spectacle is a kind of organized passivity. That means that people can consume films or novels and to see where happens all the things which don't really happen in their life. But it's not only about looking at spectacles. It's also some consuming commodities. Also, for example, buying a car means to buy that idea of maybe of liberty, of going anywhere, or of being seductive, which locks in your life. So spectacle is also politics, when people renounce to act in the first person and they just leave it to some charismatic leader. And what might be particularly interesting, look, spectacle means for them also a big deal of what is normally deemed left-wing politics is a spectacle. For example, Soviet communism and even Maoism is a spectacle, so people don't act, they're just looking. Or even the cult of Che Guevara, I could add, it's not him who says it, it can be a kind of spectacle. So the consuming images and identifying with it, contributes to social peace. And even art, which is very often opposed in that time to capitalist alienation, is seen as another form of alienation and of spectacle. So he always makes an opposition between what could be real life, which he partly finds in the past, for example, in popular life or in popular culture, which existed until the 50s. But also the possibility of future for non-spectacle. So it also means spectacle, we also have to say, is the contrary of constructed situation. So people normally don't know, it is often forgotten why they call themselves situationists. The reference was to constructed situation. That means the control which with groups of people can have over the conditions of their life, the material and intellectual conditions. So they can construct a situation which they want to live. That can also be a temporary situation. But also 68 was an enormous situation. So situation is exactly the contrary to spectacle.
So in contrast to the passive consumption
of
existing where passion or life happens in the spectacle, but not in your own alienated life. When you construct a situation, you're pushing back against that, and all of a sudden you become an active participant in your own life.
Yes, it also to retake control of its life. It was also in post-war society, De Boer, and where he had something in common with other leftist groups like Socialism and Barbarie. So
this is the post-Trotskyist group.
Yes, this approach stressed that capitalism was no longer characterized necessarily by material poverty or by proletarians in rags, but that did not mean at all that it has become a good society. But now the main opposition was between a bureaucratic caste which organizes society, not only work, they organize, for example, also housing, they organize with expelling people from the traditional popular quarter neighborhoods in the center of cities like Paris to the outskirts, or by organizing a kind of a leisure industry, like, for example, Club Mediterranee and so on. So it's interesting, really, if you read also the review, International Situationists, how that they were nearly the only people who were really aware of these transformations in everyday life and of the alienation that meant. That it, the diminution of traditional poverty was meant by no means a more fulfilled life, not even in the richest countries.
And we'll go back to that about the particular moment that these ideas were developed in, because in looking back, as we'll do further on in the program, obviously the times we live in are quite different than those of relative abundance following World War II. I should say that I'm speaking with independent scholar Anselm Yappe. He is the author of the book Guy Debord. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, let's turn to some of the influences on De Boer's thinking. You argue that in some ways he married Marxism and Surrealism, and certainly some of these preoccupations about everyday life we can see in that current. But I wonder if you could talk about the way in which Marxism and the sort of Hegelian form of Marxism influenced his writing. What did he draw from the early Marx?
Yes, but it's true that official Marxism, which was quite sclerotized and monopolized by the communist parties, normally stressed only some kind of economic dimension and was only concerned with the workers being exploited. So the discovery of the young Marx writing, which was important for many intellectuals and also fueled a lot what was called the Western Marxism in that time. Was mainly about the concept of alienation. So it means that man loses its essence, as Marx put it, that he projected his own social power and his own into outward things like the production of commodities, but also to religion. So also Marx primarily comes from a form of critic of religion. It's also interesting that the whole society of spectacle begins with an epigraph by Ludwig Feuerbach, a young Hegelian, which even before Marx said that men project into God everything they could make in their own collective life, but they do not. On the other hand, De Boer was also, I think, quite impressed by the stylistic quality also of the young Marx writing, by his also very polemical writing, and by his brilliant formulations.
And you mentioned the concept of alienation. In the young Marx, and throughout Marx's writings, the commodity is a central dimension of the Marxist critique of capitalism. Tell us about the notion of the commodity and the fetishism of the commodity for the young Marx, and to what degree De Boer drew on that.
So the very first sentence of the Society of Spectacle says more or less, all the life of modern society presents itself as a collection of spectacles. So it is.
Which is a paraphrasing.
It is a rewriting, a paraphrasing, or as Deborah put it, a détournement of the very first sentence of Marx's Capital. But the only difference, Marx says, a modern society is a collection of commodities. So to Deborah, the spectacle was a contemporary development of the commodity form. It means especially commodity what was less material and which is mainly not about the satisfaction of material needs, but also of what we could say of psychological needs, even if Deborah does not put it exactly in these terms. The commodity in Marx is a category which is existing from the beginning, but I also have to say Marx develops it much better in his later writings, what is called the Critique of Political Economy, especially in The Capital, that is published in 1967. So the commodity is not just a useful thing or not even a service, because a commodity can be material or immaterial, that's not the question, but the commodity is an object where the use value is a secondary thing is composed to its value, and the value is given only by the amount of labor which has been used with it, but not the labor measured only in time. So the circulation of commodities on the markets depends only on how much labor time has been spent to realize it, and especially how much surplus labor has been spent giving finally a rise to profit.
So the utility of the object is then separated out from what it can be exchanged for and the way one assesses what it can be exchanged for.
So the utility or the beauty or the concrete side of the commodities is always subordinated to the possibility to represent a big enough sum of money and also of profit. This is not a question of the wickedness of capitalists, which is really a structural anonymous impersonal system. So Deborah is quite critical towards the later Marx, which he sometimes deems him to be too much determinist and not enough immediately revolutionary. But on the other hand, I think it is one of the great merits of Deborah to have retaken the critics, Marx categories of the critic of political economy, especially criticism of commodity, of labor, of money, and which is very different from traditional Marxism, which often already presupposes something necessary or something unavoidable, that there is money in society, that there is labor, that there is commodities, and so he rediscovers a much more radical aspect of Marx, which really does not satisfy itself with a better distribution of the fruits of capitalist richness, but which questions the nature of capitalist richness.
So the process of this division of value and the way it shifts, it obscures our notions of ourselves, of the product of our labors, and kind of the society that we live in. There's an obscuring aspect to this. And this is a theme that's taken up by the Hungarian Marxist Georg Lukács in his book, History and Class Consciousness, which was published in 1923. This work proves quite important to De Boer's thinking. Lukács later disavowed History and Class Consciousness, but it became very popular in the 1960s. What does Lukács argue in that book?
So in that book, which he published, as you said, in 1923, but which he really quickly disavowed to become an orthodox Leninist, he stressed also the importance of alienation and the fact that a revolutionary process also means that the revolutionary subject, especially a working class, but which is not a sociological category in Lukács, but a really quite philosophical category, this kind of proletariat must recognize that the whole world is its own creation, and that it can also reappropriate of that had been what had been created by the proletariat in an unconscious manner, without knowing it. And Lukács also stressed very much also the importance of fragmented labor, of labor division, and of the alienation which is produced by that. So he called that abstract labor. So I have to say, but it's not too complicated. The abstract labor, as Marx put it, is not directly linked to the question of fragmentation of labor. Fragmentation of labor is more a historical consequence of that.
And you mean there the division of labor?
Yes, the division of labor. But it was already an important step by Lukács, and so the book completely disappeared from circulation, and it was translated in 1960 against Lukács' will into French, and De Borbon was one of its first readers, and it really shouted to De Borbon also that there was another kind of Marxism. Because we also have to remember, finally, De Borbon comes more from surrealism, and that was an older root of his ideas. Also, the idea of personal liberation, but he didn't share at all the surrealist faith in the unconscious. And so, I think he was also looking in his first years for a more rational. A foundation of his revolutionary ideas, but he couldn't find them in traditional Marxism. So the first person he encountered who represented another kind of Marxism was Henri Lefebvre, the author of The Critic of Everyday Life. And afterwards he met the writings of Lukács, which he also quotes often.
So this, in a sense, represents a sort of another thread within Marxism, yes. Which has deep roots, in fact, but much of it often, at least until the 60s, not well known. So Henri Lefebvre, who was a French thinker, famous for his Critique of Everyday Life, which was published in the two volumes following World War II, and then the second one in the 50s, he in the 1920s also encountered surrealism.
Yes.
And as the title of his major work indicates, he was particularly interested in everyday life. What did De Borbon get from Lefebvre?
The central idea of, especially of the first volume published in 1946 in Lefebvre, was the fact that that everyday life is not something just neutral, which we should not pay attention, but it is the main theater of real changes in life. In that in contemporary life is a kind of alienation, since modern society has developed so many means, especially technical and scientific means, that could lead not only to development of the forces of production, as traditional Marxists said, but should also give the possibility of having a freer life, of constructing his own everybody his own life. This is something which does not happen at all. So Lefebvre, also in the first volume of his book, he still has some confidence that everyday life could be opposed to capitalist alienation. So, he wrote it also when some popular tradition, some kind of popular autonomy was still live. And in the second volume in 1962, which is also the issue of intense dialogues with De Borbon, so he finally finds that that due also to many technical devices like television or like cars, everyday life has become really a sphere of alienation, and also that capitalist logic must also be fighted against in that sphere of life, and not only in the production sphere. And this naturally influenced very much all the social movements from 1968 on.
And then for Lefebvre and for De Borbon, one dimension of this is how everyday life is constituted in the city. Now, there's a long tradition about cities in French thinking, going back to, I guess, to Baudelaire. But what was the importance of the city for De Borbon?
Yes, so De Boer following, as you said, a long tradition, which is also by Baudelaire, by the Surrealists, thought that the material environment, and especially the city, influences very much how people think, how they feel. So the city is not just is not something given, and should not only be explored, but there should be a dialectical relationship. So. It was also a criticism he made towards surrealists. So already in the early 50s, De Boer and the other young Lettwist, they imagined a city which was constructed to be a kind of playground, which would be a terrain for adventures, and not only just a place where to go from your home to a workplace and where everything. And so for them, the city was all constructed to perpetuate social order centered on family and work. And so they developed also utopian projects of architecture. And it must also be seen that this was very much directed against the one who dominated the architecture of that time, Le Corbusier, who was not ashamed to define his architecture as a machine for dwelling. It was exactly the contrary, which the young Lettwist and the situations wanted to do. They wanted to have a city which would also be a condition for developing new passions and for developing new kinds of playing. It's interesting that the kind of foundational text of the Situationists, the report about the construction of situation, which De Boer wrote in 57 when he was 25, ends with the phrase, until now the passions have only been interpreted in different manners, and now new passions have to be developed. This was a kind of deturnment of paraphrasing of Marx's phrases, where he says the philosophers only have interpreted the world, and we have to change it.
From the thesis on Feuerbach.
But I think it's really an interesting phrase, because also you see the difference of surrealists. For surrealists, they wanted to look inside the inner depths and the unconscious and to realize them. For De Boer, it was too little. We also have to develop a new kind of psychic structure, a new kind of passion. But that cannot only be in an artistic sphere, for example. It also means to have a relationship with our material environment. And since this cannot be done on an individual scale or by little groups, it meant that there must be a social revolution. That was also how he passed from the little sectarian groups like International Lettwists to the founding of an organization that had much bigger ambitions.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about Guy Debord, the influential central figure in the Situationists, and the form of Marxism and the marriage of Marxism and Surrealism that he developed and then extended. And I'm speaking with the author of a book on Guy Debord with the same title, Guy Debord. Anselm Yappe is an independent scholar based at the Fine Arts School of Sassari in Sardinia, Italy. And his other books include The Writing on the Wall, On the Decomposition of Capitalism and Its Critics. So you've been talking about how Debord thought about the version of capitalism that afflicted Western societies at that time in the 1960s and 70s in the process of alienation. First, alienation involved replacing being with having. Mm-hmm. But under the conditions of the spectacle, having is replaced by appearing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are particular features to the kind of obstacles, the kind of way capitalism organized our daily lives and encouraged our passivity. And I wanted to ask you further about how Debord thought about how to fight the spectacle, particularly because the Situationists argued that there was the constant danger of the spectacle co-opting or recuperating, is the phrase that's often used, whatever resistance was then formed.
Yes.
In opposition.
for the both fighting against the spectacle and for the situation, it's meant leading a collective action. It could not just be a reform of personal life, and it could not just be limited to artist circles. And also, that was also a big discussion between the situation is more or less in 62, when they were and some others, they insisted that only proletarians could make this kind of revolt. So we really wanted to go outside of the cultural sphere. But on the other hand, they also insisted that proletarians were not only the factory workers, but there were many new types of proletarians. And they even said in the Society of Spectacle, all the people who have lost the control of their lives and who know it, to have some conscience about it. So that could also mean, for example, all the people deported from victims of what still was not called gentrification and deported to the outskirts. They also interested from some time in some forms of young marginals and criminals, which were called blouson noir, and in other forms of lumpen proletariat. But there was also some kind of ambiguity. On the other hand, they are still looking very much towards the factory proletariat. And they said, that especially in 68, that the student revolt was interesting, especially only when it really succeeded in fueling a workers' opposition. So they printed, for example, during the occupation of the Sorbonne in May 68, they made also print big manifestos where workers were called to occupy factories. So what really happened was effectively that about 10 million of people went on a wildcat strike. So it was really historically something absolutely never seen. But they did not push towards occupation of factories and other central issues. So because one of the reasons was also that the Communist Party was still in control of its of the working class, a big part of the working class.
And was a conservative force.
Yes. So they signed an accord with the goal to reestablish the order. The situation is we're also aware that the demands about the liberation of everyday life could also be easily become converted into new demands of commodities, and so helping the consumer society when, for example, as I said, the free time which was created by the diminishing labor time could just be devoted to the leisure industry, to television, to sport, and this is really interesting to say that the situation did have very, very little illusions, and they also understood that even radical ideas can finally be transformed just in some kind of more, let's say, of a more liberal version of capitalism. And so we also find it a lot in the films De Boer made in the 70s.
Well, which raises the question of how capitalism of that era, of the era of the revolt of 1968, how much has changed from then to now? Because in the period that the Situationists were writing, you had, particularly in Western Europe, a situation of relative affluence, even with the working class, full employment, much more job stability than anything we could recognize now, when work has become very precarious. And so the kind of the boredom of the office worker or people who, you know, weren't struggling materially but whose lives were impoverished, that was the central focus of the Situationist and De Boer's writings. But now we find ourselves in a changed world where, during the neoliberal era, where work has become precarious, where the standard of living has fallen, and the commodification of everyday life, if anything, has been accelerated. So to what degree do you think the ideas that De Boer and the Situationists had stand the test of time, given the shift in capitalism from then to now?
I think they stated it at least partially, since they always insisted that the society, spectacle society, must be abolished as a whole and not only getting better.
Getting improved in some way.
It is true that the situation is, as nearly all observers of that time, So it is an evidence that capitalism will always continue as an affluent society. Also because, as was the reasoning, this was in the interest of capitalist society to corrupt people or to have them stay quiet by giving them a material satisfaction. And the only insatisfaction could come from a subjective basis, from the fact that everyday life is unbearable. This is something which we also find, for example, in Marcuse and other authors of Frankfurt School. It's true that from the end of the 70s, things changed a lot. There was a return of the crisis of capitalism, which effectively was not foreseen by nearly nobody of these observators. Also because, finally, the reflection in terms of critic of political economy was insufficient. And that is also why, at least me personally, after writing the book about the Boer, I engage in a critical current which is called the critic of value, which started in Germany with the Review Crisis and in North America with author Moishe Postone and his book Time, Labor and Social Domination. So I won't by no means say that the critic of value is a successor of situationists, also because they nearly knew nothing about situationists, and also because there are also big theoretical differences, but to me, it is nearly the only approach which has the same degree of radicalism in theory as heterosituationists. So it is evident that that some situationist ideas, as for example, living without dead time, can be recuperated in this kind of liberalization of capitalism as today, where, for example, often precarity is even presented as a more interesting, a more exciting life than the old dull life of Fordist times, if it's guaranteed careers.
Sure, or flexible time that allows you to, reorganize your schedule, but it also can allow you to work 24 hours a day.
But it is clear that, at least in De Boer's writing, you can find nothing that found this kind of lectures for De Boer. It was always sure that the capitalist society must be abolished in its foundations.
Well, then, what do you think we can draw from his writings? One of the things that you observe is that De Boer was prescient about the ecological crisis,
yes,
even really preceding the shift of awareness in Europe to the ecological crisis. And you also mentioned that he, although it was not seamless, that he had, and the situationist had, a much broader notion of the working class. Do you think those are two of the most important elements of that legacy that are relevant today?
Yeah, so De Boer already in 1961 in a film, he said the question is not only if people live more or less poorly, but always in a way which escapes them. The naturally question of poverty is not at all without importance, but even if there are material improvements, that really does not give us back some kind of power over our own lives. So we are always under control, not so much of a personal control, but also controlled by an anonymous, impersonal mechanism, which is the market and the state. So if you ask today where there can be a kind of the fashionable word empowerment. So an empowerment cannot be only of some specific groups. So an empowerment, it should be the possibility to control our own lives. Also, because society and its development had overcome the dependency from nature, society, for example, could starve the danger of starvation in every year when it did not rain enough, for example. But we have changed it for another kind of dependency. But this dependency has nothing natural. This dependency is something socially constructed. That is what Marx calls fetishism. So let me also say it's important that Marx, the Marxian concept of commodity fetishism does not mean a veiling of something, a mystification of something which is hidden. It is something much more broader. Commodity fetishism means that men create their own society, but they have no hold of it. Not even the capitalists have it, because The production of used goods is only a kind of secondary consequence of the only thing that really matters, which is the transformation of living labor in money.
So, in terms of thinking about what we can draw from De Boer right now, in terms of struggling in a situation, I think he, in the end of his life, was afflicted with a certain melancholia. Certainly, the left today, whatever the left is actually today, can be seen to have something similar with kind of the defeat of the left going over decades and then intersecting with this intensifying ecological crisis certainly reinforces a kind of pessimism. And of course, the notion of the spectacle in some ways can also reinforce that pessimism. Is there any way out, you know, that capital has this way or the society is structured in such a way that is not only alienating but so politically demobilizing that it's very difficult for people to shake that off and come together collectively to think about other imaginaries and other ways of living and fighting for those things right now? I mean, are there any dimensions of De Boer's thinking that you think is particularly useful at a kind of conjuncture like we're in?
Especially in the last decades, even what oppositional thinking has very often lost its focus on society as a whole and is very often focusing only on specific issues as women's issues or gender issues, racial issues, and so on. Naturally, these things may be important, but it has become very often a way of integration into the capitalist system. So it became only the demand that everybody should have his or her chance to get inside the system. So that the whole capitalist and technological society too is based on a kind of expropriation of our living possibilities is something which is often really forgotten. I think this question is often put a little bit more in the ecological movement, but on the other hand, it is very often limited by very reformistic and very modest proposals. So also to get rid of the ecological crisis, we have to get rid of this infernal machine of making always more money. And this is naturally a question of production, but also of consumption. That's why also quoting still another phrase from De Boer's report from 1957, where he says, "We shall attack everywhere the bourgeois idea of happiness." So this is naturally something very important on a collective basis also. So what people are really consider as something desirable for themselves, so what do they want to fight for? So if they only want to fight for getting access to a consumer society, naturally they or they don't succeed. Or if they succeed, they will just be a kind of rescue army for a capitalism which is in its full crisis. But this also means to stress a thing, an idea with which maybe many people on the left do not agree. That's the idea that capitalism is in full crisis. So the critic of value very much underlines that. So capitalism may have still high profits of some companies, but in its whole, capitalism is in a total crisis, as we especially see in the enormous debt. So there is nearly no real production of value, and capitalism continues going on from one decade to the other, always writing more zeros beyond the enormous debts. And that also means we are in a period of possible social transformation. So I would not so much say of melancholy or of defeat. What has been defeated is a left which was really, whose horizon was only the capitalist horizon, who only wanted a better redistribution. It was the Keynesian left, which has really been defeated, because there is no more possibility for a kind of class compromise inside the capitalist system. A lot of leftists are disillusioned today because they see that the categories where they too believe like money, like power of purchase and so are disappearing. But it also means that today it is it has become more clear that overcoming capitalism means also to develop other forms of life, and also means to have to develop other forms of imaginary.
Well, let me end by asking about precisely that, because connected, as you're saying, to the pessimism of the left, there really is an absence of different visions of how life could be. I mean, one of the things that seems very striking when one looks back to May 68, in all its problems, is the boldness of the vision too. You know, this notion of full transformation of life right now. And do you think that some aspect that can be, even in the face of pessimism, drawn on, and should that be, is that a necessary ingredient in terms of thinking about social transformation at this moment?
One important thing in the situation is that they criticize as much the market as the state. Today you have, especially in Europe, you often have a left who evokes the state as a, or the politics as a kind of solution which shall give limits to economy. And this is, for example, it's one of the illusions which the situation is destroyed or should have destroyed. Afterwards, effectively, you don't find in the situation is a clear political strategy which you could apply today. But I think it is also a kind of appeal to not compromise with this kind of system. What is also, so I didn't want to speak about the boss life, personal life, but I think it's really interesting. The boss showed that you can completely stay outside the spectacle, so that the boss never appeared in public, but it does not at all mean to renounce of influencing the world you live in. So the boss can widespread your ideas even without using the channels prepared by the society of spectacle.
Anselm Yape, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Guy Debord, and I should say that's published by PM Press, and in the interest of full disclosure, I have a connection to PM Press. Anselm Yape is an independent scholar based at the... Now I may have to turn this on. The Fine Arts School of Sassari.
Sassari, yes.
The Fine Arts School of Sassari in Sardinia. His other books include The Writing on the Wall, On the Decomposition of Capitalism and Its Critics, and The Adventure of the Commodity. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.